I'm starting to think seasonal allergies are some kind of bullshit. Like, not that they're not real, but that I have, in the last few years, gotten really bad seasonal allergies. And it seems like every single year, it is not only worse, but that everybody else is saying, oh, you know, I read or heard, blah, 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 this is the worst year ever for pollen or whatever, whatever.
Yeah, of course it is.
How is every year the worst year ever? And this sounds like something is wrong.
How is every year the hottest year ever? I don't know if they're linked together, but it could be that it makes for, you know, a greenhouse effect, let's call it. It might make for easier to have more growing things that produce more pollen. I have no idea if that is even the case, but doesn't it sound plausible?
What I see is a problem that used to not exist as much, that now is exploding in existence, and it seems to affect tons of people. And the best thing we can do is take medicines that not only don't work, but that when they don't work, the people who tell you to take them say, oh, well, it didn't work this time because you didn't start taking it a few weeks beforehand, you're building up a tolerance, it'll start working eventually. I mean, it's like, I feel like I'm spending whatever it is, $1.50 a day on these pills that do nothing. Every year, it's worse and worse. I don't know. So, when I was a kid, I used to take allergy shots because I had bad allergies, and that made them a lot better. And I heard adults do allergy shots sometimes for seasonal allergies. Do any of you have, you in the chat, does anybody have experience with that? Because I would gladly do allergy shots again if it could fix this. Because every year, at least in the spring, sometimes also in the fall, I'm just useless for like 2 weeks. And with a combination of like sick kids season in the winter preceding this, it's just exhausting and it makes it hard to do anything.
You should try homeopathic, whatever, however you pronounce it. What are some of those remedies? Because I hear they work really well.
Oh, I'm already taking them by not taking them. I'm taking the maximum effective dose by not taking them at all. So I'm like, right? Like divide by zero, something like that works out, right?
So let's do some follow-up. And it starts with, we got a lot of feedback about how Walmart is energy efficient. And I don't even recall having talked about that in the prior episode. I remember talking about energy efficiency, of course, but I guess one of us made some sort of flippant comment about it and have.
Yeah, that was me. I threw Walmart under the bus because they're the standard bearer for a terrible giant American company, right? And so I just assumed that they were also the type of company that would pinch pennies and not bother investing in green energy. But that is not the case. We will link to a Walmart's website where they would talk about all their renewable plans. They plan to be 100% renewable energy by 2020. So they're not quite where Apple is today, but they have plans to get there. They have a whole big page on their website about sustainability. I hesitate to say this because I'm sure we'll just get more email from people telling me that Walmart doesn't do anything bad ever.
Well, that's not true.
I only wish that their sustainability that they have on this page extended to the sustainability of their workforce, as in paying them enough to be alive and healthy and not relying on, if they can't get pay and benefits through us, the government will pick up the slack. Anyway, I don't like Walmart, have you noticed? But they are actually doing solar stuff, so I was wrong on that. So there you go. Walmart boosters, they're out there.
In Walmart's defense, which is probably a phrase you will never hear me say again, but in Walmart's defense, if you look at other retailers like Amazon, for instance, it's often not a lot better. What's mostly at fault here is retail is a terrible and extremely cutthroat business, and government regulations on things like minimum wage simply don't go far enough. Okay, please do email us. Next topic.
Well, no, I wouldn't call that in Walmart's defense. That would just be saying, like, Walmart does bad things, and also other people do too, and so they're also bad. It doesn't make them any better to find other people who do the bad thing. And we're not going to get into this, you know, like, well, if, you know, like the minimum wage is like, well, if my other, if my competitors can pay their employees this low, and we don't, we're going to go out of business. Anyway, yes, there's lots of blame to go around, but Walmart is far from blameless. But they do put solar panels on the roof of things. So they've got that going for them.
One thing they do, okay.
All right. So why don't you tell us about USB ports on the iPad Pro? Because apparently we're all confused about it.
We are?
No, I'm not confused. I was just thinking about it the other day. It's not what you think. It's not like, oh, the USB 2 speeds on the 9.7-inch iPad and stuff like that. What I was thinking about is you've got this relatively huge iPad Pro, the big one, and even the, you know, the regular size iPad has a lot of room on it. And these days, the only thing on them, now that they've removed like the rotation lock and everything, is like power, volume, and of course the home button and the Touch ID sensor, but then this one tiny little lightning port on the side. And I was like, well, what's the next step for the big iPad Pro? You got keyboards you can attach to them. It's got a smart connector on the side. It's got a stylus. And I was mostly inspired by Marco talking last week about, oh, you could always hook up USB things to iPads and iOS devices, and they would just magically work if you could somehow find a way to power them if they didn't get enough power from the port and stuff like that, like the drivers are all in there. So the big iPad Pro, why would you not have actual USB ports on it? I mean, I guess not more than one, because you wouldn't want them to be more powerful than the MacBook One, right? But anyway, why wouldn't you, as opposed to having like a camera adapter and all this other stuff, like, you know, or I'm going to say an SD card slot, but there's just so much freaking room on the big iPad Pro. But as far as USB connectors, Apple has painted itself into kind of a corner with the Lightning thing, because the practical reason why you wouldn't put USB connectors on the iPad is if you did put them there, they'd be USB Type-C, and USB Type-C looks a hell of a lot like Lightning, and I can just imagine people jamming their Lightning into the USB-C ports or vice versa, and that's like a nightmare as a usability. I mean, how could you distinguish between those two ports? They are different sizes, physically speaking, and probably the big one can't fit into the small one, but
I don't think that's the reason.
Well, right, but I mean, I think it would be a natural evolution of especially the very big iPad Pro to have actual USB ports on it eventually, right? But I don't see how that can happen when Lightning looks so much like USB-C. So I wonder how Apple will square that. And if the answer is, oh, we're never going to have more than a Lightning port on that, I'm not entirely sure that's the best long-term answer if they really want especially the big iPad Pro to become more and more of a viable laptop replacement.
Ultimately, there are so many reasons why you can conceivably think of why Apple would not be putting USB ports on iPads and iOS devices in general.
But why wouldn't you put it on the big one long term? Like, I understand obviously why you're not going to put it on like most of the iOS line, but when you get up into something that's so big that it's so obviously not intended to be just a slip it into your bag type of thing, but it's like it's the size of a laptop. Why does that not get one, I guess, you know, Thunderbolt 3 port or whatever? Because there's so much you can do. Like, there's so many doors that opens in terms of how usable is it on your desk as opposed to when you're walking around with it, that it's almost a shame to be constrained by Lightning forever.
I mean, it's possible they will at some point. You know, we never say never with Apple, and especially with a product line that is kind of on the way down, it's, you know, sales-wise. Like, Apple has done a lot of things with the recent iPads that we thought they'd never do, in an effort to broaden it or help it find its feet or, you know, help increase sales in some way or another. So I think they very well might do something like that in the future. I think there's lots of reasons why they haven't done it so far, and I think they can very easily get past the physical challenges of how do you fit a port, and then how do you avoid confusion with the other port. I think they can get around that with, you know, either by punting and not solving the problem and just putting a USB-C port on there, which is not that unlikely, or ship a dongle or something. I mean, you know, make a new standard of USB micro-C and, you know, declare it an industry standard, even though nothing else besides Apple devices will have it for 3 years. And, then that's, you know, they could solve that problem. Like, that is not the reason they're not doing it. And if they wanted to do it, they would get around that problem.
Yeah, I would like to see how they would get around with it, because USB Type-C seems like, I mean, supposedly Apple had a lot of influence in that connector. It looks a lot like Lightning. It's, from all accounts, a pretty good connector as far as those things go. Having to come up with a new one just because the existing one that hopefully by that point everybody in the industry actually uses, and it really is an industry standard because Apple didn't make it up, having to come up with one more weird connector, I don't know. It seems like a shame to me. It seems like a shame in the same way that it has always been a shame, and it continues to be a shame, that Microsoft chose the same modifier key as Unix, meaning that if you want to do Unixy stuff on Windows, it's a battle between the Unixy environment and the Windows environment of, like, you know, Control C, does that mean, you know, send the interrupt signal or copy text? And it, you know, depends on where you are. Whereas Apple, through mostly accidents of history, happen to not have that problem because the Mac operating system uses the command key and to a much, much lesser extent, the control key. So the control key is almost entirely available to the Unix environment. So when they did the chocolate and peanut butter combination that is or was Mac OS X and now is OS X, it was beautiful and you didn't have to worry about that conflict. And I feel like Apple is on the Windows control key for the OS side of the equation with its Lightning ports, basically making it a little bit extra bit of a pain in the butt. You know, they have now they have a problem to solve, whereas these devices that are just USB-C from top to bottom won't have that problem to solve. Their only problem will be like, how many of these USB-C ports do we put on our cool new laptop replacement tablet thing? I forget if the Surface has USB-C ports on it, but anyway, if they wanted to, it seems like a thing they could do much more easily than Apple. And it's one of those problems where it's like, well, couldn't Windows have changed that? But they added the Windows key. They could have changed their modifier, but it's just, it has so much inertia and it would annoy so many people that Windows continues to lurch along with the control key being the modifier for everything.
Well, don't worry. Windows will never have any kind of Unix support.
Yeah, did you see that Ubuntu thing? Yeah, I know. It's... I don't think, I mean, that's Unix is never going to change. You're not going to take the control key away from them. And it's in the grand scheme of things, it's a small issue, but it's one of those things that makes me happy about my combination of Mac and Unix every time I deal with it. And looking at the iPad and that Lightning port and the USB-C port shape, it makes me furrow my brow a bit.
So, I mean, this is not on our topic list, which is why I'm going to derail us into talking about it. Why do you think they haven't put a USB port on an iPad so far, and what do you think they could do with it? I mean, I think the former is easy to explain. Like, why they haven't done it so far, I think the big things are that it seemed like the past, they wanted to move forward from that and didn't want to build in support for all these devices and deal with all the technical and software complexity of that. And also, they kind of like things to be all kind of enclosed. For instance, one of the things that you would want a USB port for would be additional storage, and they don't want you to do that. They want you to buy it from them. So I think there's lots of reasons why they haven't done it before. What do you think could motivate them to add USB-like ports for kind of general use on the iPad Pro?
I've seen people use the little camera connection kit that has a USB port on it. And the only time I think I've ever seen it was you doing live broadcasts when we're in San Francisco for WWDC. I know that Jason Snell is, you know, played around with it, as have others, but I cannot think of anyone other than you, Marco, that I've ever seen use the USB to Lightning or in the past USB to dock connectors. So I just don't feel like there's much of a market for it. Like, I can't think of anything that I would want to plug into my iPad other than maybe the memory card from my camera or the camera itself, hence the connector, the dongle being called the camera connector. I don't see why one would want this.
Well, it's a kind of, as with all these things, it's in a race with the, we talked about this many shows ago, it's in a race with the wireless technologies, right? So there's lots of wireless standards out there for everything from wireless display to wireless power to all, you know, obviously we have wireless networking and that has become pervasive. So it really kind of is a race between the eventual need to do some of the things that USB does on tablet type devices and how long it takes for all those wireless standards to become, to reach their Wi-Fi moment where they finally become good enough for general use and they just spread everywhere. Because no one loves wires. Like, if you could have,
I love wires,
wireless display and, you know, wireless storage and wireless power, so you just come up to your desk with your laptop and put it down and your big screen in front of you turns on, like, of course, who wouldn't want that, right? I mean, especially with things like monitors that you plug into the wall. It's not like you have to recharge the batteries in your monitor. The monitor would still be plugged in. You just didn't have to deal with it. Anyway, we're not there yet, obviously, with those. But so setting that aside and the fact that could swamp all of this, the reason you eventually want something like USB on the big iPad or whatever is, I mean, it's the same reason they added a stylus, right? Or they made the big version. They're extending the capabilities of the device, you know, and or multitasking with a split screen. They want people to be able to do things with these devices that they couldn't do with the simpler ones. And it's because they're becoming more powerful. They're becoming, you know, there was someone posted recently, I think it was Jeff Atwood tweeted something about, like, look at all of the CPUs that have ever been in, I think it was Microsoft Surface, or I forget what it was. Some other, you know, slim sort of something that people accept as a laptop replacement. And look at how many of them are slower than the iPad Pro, right? If the top end of technology in terms of computing power is not growing as fast as it used to, and we'll talk about Intel's TikTok stuff later in the show, eventually these things that are historically lesser devices, laptops and eventually tablets and eventually supposedly phones, will slowly creep up and start closing the gap. And you will be left with a situation where a big iPad Pro can have all the power. I mean, if they just don't update the Mac Pro anymore, eventually a big iPad Pro will have all the power of the current Mac Pro because they'll never freaking update the machine again. and if you have a small, you know, it's again, if the price and size of compute starts dropping to zero, then you will want to have a little thing like that that you carry around with you in your bag that you chuck on your desk and that when you do so, you can connect to all the peripherals that you'd want in a big desk environment. You could have multiple monitors hooked up. You can have larger storage. You could have wired networking for faster transfers. You could have all sorts of other peripherals. And the question is, do you need to plug them in or are they all wireless? So at this point, with today's technology, a lot of them you need to plug in. So that's why I'm saying like a Thunderbolt 3 port, like we keep saying USB. But, you know, you'd hook it up and you'd have two external monitors. Maybe you hook it up and you have a big, giant touchscreen that's like 27 inches that's, you know, like laid out on your table instead of being in front of you or whatever, so you could do more complicated stuff. And it's like, why wouldn't I have a desktop computer to that? How can an iPad drive something, drive peripherals that powerful? Eventually, it will be able to. Again, especially if the top end it continues to grow more slowly than the bottom end. So I feel like the functionality currently enabled by a Thunderbolt port or a USB 3 port inevitably will come to tablet-class devices, assuming tablet-class devices still exist, if not like VR devices or whatever. The only question is, when that comes to pass, will we need to use a USB connector to do it, or will it all be wireless, or will there be some other standard?
So here's an interesting thought experiment. We've had wireless things in general, wireless protocols, wireless networking, wireless, you know, device interconnection standards, things like Bluetooth, Wi-Fi. We've had these things now for a long time in technology terms, you know, over 10 years where we've had these things. Not only have they been, you know, possible, but they've been like ubiquitous for over 10 years and very widely supported and really quite mature for what they are. And yet, if you look at the devices we use, with the exception of things that are fully integrated like iPads, but you know, if you look at like a laptop or a desktop computer, things that do connect to other peripherals or other pieces of hardware like monitors and stuff, almost all of that is still using wires that was using wires 10 years ago. Like, it seems like as the wireless things have gotten better, so have the wired versions of the various connection protocols and everything. And everyone's still using wires for lots of good reasons. Like, I love wires because they simply work better most of the time. Like, they're usually more reliable. They're often faster. They can go in places where wireless kind of can't, like high interference environments or, you know, certain restricted areas like planes where you don't necessarily need a bunch of wireless stuff. They have advantages in things like power delivery and battery usage and everything else. So wires are kind of, I think they're here to stay. Like, everyone always assumes that in the future, everything will be wireless, you know, as you said, like, you know, interfacing with your monitor, interfacing with the stuff on your desk. But maybe that's not true. Maybe that's not a safe assumption, because I think we've had long enough now with wireless interconnection things that have been possible, and yet we're still using wires for all these things because they just work better.
But no one uses wires for networking anymore. They take the Ethernet ports right off the devices. Like, as soon as Wi-Fi was good enough, not good, because we always know it's flaky, it's slower. Like, we all know the limitations of Wi-Fi. It's you know, you get interference from your microwave oven, and you have interference from your portable phones and your thing, and you can't get on the network, and, you know, you keep dropping. Like, Wi-Fi has problems. But as soon as it got good enough, people were like, well, screw these things, because no one wants to walk from place to place or run wires through their house or plug things in or whatever.
I do all of those things.
But some things is just not possible. Like, you know, having the you know, wireless display technology, so you don't, you know, all those sort of laptop docks that you see in offices and the many different incarnations they come in, and then, no, I don't want a dock, I just want one cable to plug in or whatever it is. It's not that bad to plug something in. But if you told those people, in the same way that we told them, hey, every time you sit down at your desk, you won't have to plug the Ethernet cable in and out anymore, it doesn't seem like a big deal. Like, who cares? I plug in one cable, it's fine. It's really convenient. It's you know, it works every time. It's not a big deal. But Wi-Fi just wiped all that stuff off the face of the earth. There is no equivalent to Wi-Fi. I would say Bluetooth isn't even the equivalent to Wi-Fi, because I think Bluetooth has still not passed the level of non-flakiness for anything except for devices that never move. You know, keyboards and mice, I think people more or less accept Bluetooth, but then there's the annoyance of the battery charging that wasn't there with wire, so it has a downside. So I feel like Bluetooth is borderline, but no other wireless technology for anything else, like storage or monitors or anything like that, is remotely up to the net win that Wi-Fi was. But it doesn't mean that they never will be. I mean, you just read any sci-fi book, like, technologically speaking, there's no reason you couldn't have really sophisticated, high-speed, ubiquitous, short-range, high-bandwidth Wi-Fi, and even the power delivery stuff.
So you're saying on a very long time scale.
it doesn't have to be that long. I mean, do you know people who use wireless charging for their phones?
Does that really exist? I mean, like, yeah, like those stupid little pads. Like,
yeah. I mean, obviously, you can buy them for Apple devices too. But most people who use them, I would imagine, use them for some kind of Android device that is not a third party thing, but it comes with the thing. But I know people who choose to do that. Like, no one's forcing them to use that. They find it convenient that when they come home, they put all their devices on a big pad, or they put it in a little cradle. And it's like, well, if you're putting it in a cradle, if there was a little plug at the bottom of the cradle, would it make a big difference if you plug it in and plug it? They're choosing, and they're, you know, these are not always the biggest technology nerds. It's just more convenient when I don't have to deal with the plug. I just put it on this thing and it charges. It's not great. It's slower. It's not good enough for everybody yet. But the fact that anybody chooses to do it in its current sad, unsupported state shows that there is a desire for it. So I feel like the convenience hooks of all of those wireless things are impossible to resist as soon as they pass the minimum, you know, sort of reliability threshold. And Wi-Fi is the best example, and I think the only one that has passed it, and Bluetooth is on the border. Everything else, it's like, all right, well, keep revising the protocols, and a few early adopters will try it, and then, you know, revise. We'll know when it crosses the threshold, because Apple will have it all over the place, because Apple doesn't want any ports on any of its devices. They don't even want rotation lock switch, for crying out loud.
That still drives me nuts.
There was no room on the side of the device. It couldn't be a millimeter bigger. Sorry, Casey. We had that empty space for the four speakers. They need every millimeter of that empty space. It's impossible to make the device different.
They should just have a mute switch bump. I mean, if they'll have a camera bump to accommodate that wide component, they should have a mute switch bump on the other side. Then it could be even.
The mute switch is a bump. Like, that's what makes it a switch. It sticks out, and you can slide it back and forth. They'll make it a Touch ID button. You'll have to use your fingerprint to mute.
Yeah, it won't work if your hand's wet.
Yeah. You know the wet hand trick, though, right?
What?
No.
So the problem with Touch ID sensors that people found as soon as they were introduced is they work fine, but then you go do the dishes, and then you try to unlock your phone, and it doesn't work, and you're annoyed. And eventually your hand's dry, and it works again. All you got to do is wet your hands a lot, and then train it on your wet finger. You can label it as, you know, wet right thumb. And then you will train it on your dry right thumb, and you'll train it on your wet right thumb, and both will work. Life hack.
Well, that was always my... So there was that like court case or whatever where somebody at some point ruled that the police can't ask you for your passcode, but they can force you to use your fingerprint to unlock your phone. So my contingency plan, in case I ever get questioned by the police and they force me to access my phone...
Suck your thumb?
What would be you lick my finger for a second and then make Touch ID fail three times, so then it would require the passcode and then I wouldn't have to let them in.
Just bring Casey with you and he'll spill water on your phone and they'll never be able to use it. You got to do that before the waterproof iPhone 7 comes out.
Yeah, I think it's already too late, because the 6S is already, you know, almost waterproof, right? Isn't it like fairly waterproof?
I think it's only waterproof on YouTube. In the magic realm of YouTube, you can put it in a glass of water and it's fine. If you do it at home, it instantly dies.
I don't even know where to go from here. Are we in follow-up? Are we like three topics deep? I don't even know what's happened to the show.
We've got one item of follow-up left.
Oh, God. When you're in charge, Marco, everything takes a turn.
He's never in charge.
No, this is a life lesson. Exactly. I'm not in charge. I just kind of took charge, because that's how life works.
God. You need an agent of chaos, as they say.
Yeah, something like that.
No one ever grants you authority. You have to take it.
All right. Well, I'm taking authority and saying, let's get through this one damn last piece of follow-up so we can get into the real topics.
Our sponsor this week is Casper. Casper is an online retailer.
You're the worst.
I know, but Casper isn't. They're an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. The mattress industry has inherently forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper revolutionizes the industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to you, the consumer. Casper mattresses provide resilience and long-lasting supportive comfort. It's one of a kind. It's a new hybrid-style mattress that combines premium latex foam with memory foam. So it gives you the best of both. You don't have like the super hot feeling of memory foam pure mattresses, but you still get that kind of nice cushiony support with this combination. Now, mattresses, usually for a good mattress, you're paying well over $1,500. But Casper mattresses cost between $500 for a twin all the way up to $950 for a king and everything in between for the various sizes. Now, these prices are incredible. $950 for a high-quality king mattress is just unheard of. Now, Casper understands that buying a mattress online can have you wondering how this is possible. So it's completely risk-free, and they offer free delivery and free returns within a 100-day period. It's that simple. So here's how this works. They ship you the mattress in like a kind of file cabinet size box. It's kind of this compressed state because it's foam, so it can expand. When you open it up, it expands, kind of fills the room, and then you have giant mattress. You sleep on it for 100 nights. And if you don't like it at the end of that, you can call them up, and they will arrange for a free, painless return. They'll send somebody to your house to pick it up. All for free. So it's totally risk-free if you don't like it. Chances are you will, though, because this is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. These two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together to give you just the right sink, just the right bounce. With this risk-free trial and return policy, just try it for 100 days. Try sleeping on a Casper mattress, free delivery, painless returns, and these mattresses are made in America. Check it out. Go to casper.com/ATP. And you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by using code ATP. Terms and conditions do apply to that. Thank you very much to Casper for sponsoring our show this week.
All right, John, your crowning moment has come. Tell us about what's going on with your TV.
Has it come? We'll see. So more than a year ago, because we revisited on the one-year anniversary, more than a year ago, I banished my PlayStation 4 from my beautiful plasma television because mostly what I was doing with my PlayStation 4 was playing Destiny, and Destiny had a heads-up display that's on screen the entire time you're playing that is 100% opacity and doesn't move and doesn't change that much, and it was burning in on my display. And I revisited a year later to see if the retention had faded, and it had faded to be almost entirely invisible, to be replaced with the Cartoon Network logo, which was also banished from my television. Anyway, so when I banished my PS4, I got a gaming monitor, I brought it into another room, and that's how I've been playing Destiny, still the main thing I do with my PS4, since then, for more than a year now. Of course, when I pulled my PS4 from the TV, Destiny was new to me. It wasn't new. I got it around the time of the first expansion. I think the first expansion. A little bit after. And I, you know, complained on the Bungie forums. The Bungie's the maker of the game. And I say, you know, it would be nice if you had an option to make the HUD translucent and or dim it or, you know, do some other thing that would help with burn-in. And it was a big thread in their forums, mostly consisted of people who don't own plasma televisions telling everyone who does that they shouldn't anymore because they're bad and that's why they should get LED televisions.
Helpful internet people.
It's just a bunch of, you know, kids. Like, they don't understand why anyone would want a plasma television. The only thing they care about is, like, my LCD television, or they always call them LED television, is great. And they get into fights with each other, and it's like, kids, calm down. Like, stop fighting over what TV you have. Like, we need to concentrate on Bungie and say, Bungie, this seems like an easy feature for you to add. Like, translucency seems like it's within your grasp, graphically speaking, on the PlayStation 4. To make the HUD translucent or make it smaller, or, you know, many games do this. They give you options to tweak your HUD, not necessarily for burn-in reasons, usually just for customization reasons, but yeah, it helps with burn-in as well.
Well, you know, there is a second option here that they could have done. You know, just never let you stop playing Destiny, because then it doesn't matter if it's burned into your TV. It's always showing anyway if you just always play Destiny. If you never use your TV for anything else,
it still matters. You would think it wouldn't matter, but it does. And anyway, you got to stop sometime. Destiny is not the only thing I did on my television. Anyway, so the gaming monitor I got is obviously does not look as good as my television. The black levels are atrocious. The response time is better. Anyway, so that's how I've been playing Destiny for a year. And the big thread in the Bungie forums, Bungie like has not really said anything official about the topic of like, other than acknowledging we have heard you about this request. And, you know, they didn't promise it. Very, very Apple-like in terms of vague acknowledgement that the issue has been received, but no promises that it will ever be addressed, let alone what time. So imagine my surprise when here I am more than a year later, Bungie was previewing some of the content they're going to have in the April update to Destiny. And one of the first things they showed was the ability to turn off the HUD. That was mostly the feature they were touting, because people who, you know, do movies within the game or take screenshots, you know, you don't want to have the HUD there sort of, you know, making it less cinematic and making it look more like a game. So you can drop the HUD for like nicer screenshots and movies and stuff. But there was also two other options of, you know, full opacity, high and low. Maybe there was a medium level. Didn't really get to see what those look like in the game, but they were there settings wise. So there will be options to turn down the HUD. I don't know if the low setting is low enough to prevent image retention, but that's not my problem. My first problem is that I spent a year playing Destiny connected to a gaming monitor, and I'm kind of used to it in terms of, if I was to go back on the television, I would feel like I'm really far away from the screen, even though, you know, you can do the math that my television screen is much bigger, but the distance wise, I wouldn't be able to see as much detail. I'm used to being closer to the screen, close enough to like see the pixels, because it's not a Retina display. It's just, you know, a 1080 HD display, just like my television, but I'm sitting like 2 feet from it instead of 8 feet away. And the other thing is, when I mentioned potentially bringing the PlayStation 4 back in, my wife said that she was not for this idea, because that will just lead to more fighting between my son, who wants to play Star Wars Battlefront, and my daughter, who wants to watch television shows. So it's better when they can be in separate rooms, each doing the thing they want to do without fighting over the big TV. So it seems to me that despite my dreams coming true here, potentially the dimming might not be sufficient to prevent burn-in. And the other thing is, and the other two issues are, I'm kind of used to it. I'm sitting 2 feet from my monitor. I'm kind of used to playing that way at this point. And for the harmony of the family, it may be better to keep my PlayStation 4 in here. Now, if they come up with a PlayStation 4.5, as the rumors are, that a slightly more powerful PlayStation 4, with that more power potentially being helpful to the PlayStation VR, which I may eventually buy, I would buy a PlayStation 4.5 and connect it to the TV, so we'd have two PlayStations and my son and I can play Destiny at the same time, finally. And my wife would probably like that even less, but I would kind of have a quote-unquote excuse. Well, it's not, I'm not just getting a second PlayStation. This is the better PlayStation, and where else am I going to put it? We don't have room for another gaming monitor. It's got to be connected to the TV. So this is a complicated situation.
By the way, as somebody who bought a PS4 only a few months ago, that really annoys me, that rumor.
Well, it's only a rumor now, and the extra power like probably wouldn't be a big deal, because it would probably just be for VR, which you'll probably buy anyway, honest. You know, like, aren't you going to buy PlayStation VR? Tiff will make you buy it.
I would like to see it. I mean, I'm not sure I will buy it, but I think it's at least somewhat likely, just because I don't plan to build a giant gaming PC to try out the Oculus.
Right.
So this is kind of like the alternative to that for more casual people like me. So I think that's, I would like to see it.
Yeah, it's cheap enough that you're like, you know what? Fine. I'm going to give it a try. This is giving it an honest shot. You're not going to be like, oh, it would be better if I had a better PlayStation. No, it'll be what it is. The experience will be consistent, and you can try it out and find out if it's terrible or not. So that's been my plan as well. But I would like a PlayStation 4.5. Anyway, the April update looks interesting. One-to-one infusion. I knew I shouldn't have used that Harrowed Anguish of Dristan that I had, 320 drop. That I was just saving and saving it. Like, just yesterday, I was like, you know what? I should just infuse that into my 309 Mida. Why the hell not? I know I'm going to lose a lot of points, but pretty soon 330, 335 stuff is going to be dropping anyways. There's no point in saving the 320. Thank God I saved it. One-to-one infusion coming in April. This ends the gibberish portion of the episode.
Yeah, Casey, is John okay?
I don't know.
Do you think? Should we call somebody?
Hand on heart, I'm not trying to be funny. I really thought that I had just spaced out and the conversation went a totally different direction. I was trying feverishly to catch up and figure out what the crap John was just saying. And then, oh, he's just talking Destiny again. Never mind.
Next, we'll have Marco tell us about watch terminology.
I can't even. All right. So is that, are we good with follow-up? Any other follow-up, gentlemen?
We're all done.
Excellent. All right. So I don't recall exactly when this happened. I think it was a little over a week ago, but last episode we were busy talking about the Apple event, so we didn't get a chance to talk about it. Some things happened in the Node.js world last week. Some interesting things. We have a link in the show notes to HaneyCodes.net, which is sharing my experiences as a programmer in C#.net and engineering manager. And this person, whose name I don't know other than Haney, anyway, they wrote a very quick article about, or a reasonably quick article about, what happened on NPM. And I'm going to take a stab as the summarizer in chief, and you guys can interrupt when you're ready. There was a person who had put up a package called Kik, K-I-K, and the, what is it, a chat app or something like that? The people who run that got in touch with him and were upset that he had a package that I don't think in any way related to Kik the app, had a package that just had the same name. And so they told him he should take it down. He said no. And then I guess they went to NPM, which is the package manager, node package manager that you use with Node, and they got NPM to take it down. And he then, this gentleman, decided to rage quit NPM and remove all of his packages. So far, this is a kind of amusing but unremarkable story, except that one of the packages that he removed was a package that, what was this called?
LeftPad, was it? It was like a 12-line string function.
Yes, you are right. It is called LeftPad. It is a 12-line or 11-line function that just pads a string on the left-hand side. And apparently a lot of very popular packages took this as a dependency. So in other words, you know, when you're writing code in the modern times, you usually have a package manager, something like CocoaPods or NuGet or NPM, or what does Perl use? Something ancient?
Something ancient?
Yeah. Everything in Perl's ancient.
Something with actual tests that run against the code so you can tell whether
they
actually work.
I couldn't resist. But that's CPAN, right? Or something like that?
You got it.
Okay. So most modern development platforms and Perl have a package manager, and NPM is the one for this. And when you have this package manager, it makes it very easy to import somebody else's code. So apparently what all of these packages did, including some very, very, very popular ones, was they imported this LeftPad package, and this entire package was 11 lines of code. Well, when this package disappeared, that meant that anyone who had already downloaded it was okay, but if you tried to, say, code on a new machine, or in many cases, redeploy, then this package was gone, and all of a sudden, everything broke. And because so many popular packages took this as a sub-dependency, if you will, like half of the Node ecosystem broke. And this was really chapping a lot of people's butts, because a lot of the really smug developers, pretty much all of whom were right, said, why would you take an 11 line dependency? Why not just write those 11 lines yourself, or just put them somewhere in your project, somewhere under your control? And there was a big kerfuffle about it. And I, as someone who has written a Node app, which is my blog, and I just recently reran Clock, which is Count Lines of Code, on my blog, and I put up a short blog post about it, which we'll put in the show notes. The entirety of my blog engine, in terms of the things that I have written, is 850 lines of code. Then I did a Count Lines of Code on my Node packages or Node modules folder, and that was 180,000 lines of code. So I'm not really one to throw stones on this issue, but nevertheless, I don't think it's really useful to poop all over package managers and the idea of taking dependencies, just carte blanche, it's a bad idea. I don't think that's necessarily true. I do think, however, that taking an 11-line dependency is a bit ridiculous. So, Marco, as chief curmudgeon when it comes to these sorts of things, what are your thoughts?
First of all, I think John might be even more curmudgeonly than me on this, but
so you might be right.
I'm at least better known for avoiding dependencies like this. And the reason why I avoid dependencies as much as I can is not because I've always been like this. It's because of experiences that I had, mostly during the early days of Tumblr. Lots of things that we used in the early days broke. Lots of third-party components, lots of application layer stuff, infrastructure components that were not very widely used or were very young or were not designed to be used at big scales. But most of the problems we had were third-party PHP modules, third-party PHP code written by other people that we imported so we wouldn't have to write our own functions for things like S3 or image resizing and stuff like that. We had so many problems with this code, especially the frickin' Zend framework. I don't know if it's good now, but it sure wasn't then. we had so many problems with like almost every third-party library that we used that we eventually just said, you know what, we're just going to not use any anymore, because it every time we would use one, literally, not just sometimes, literally the majority of the time, 6 months later, we would be ripping it out and replacing it with either another third-party one that would break 6 months after that, or finally we'd write our own, because they just were of low quality and were not designed for a high-needs environment, or were not designed for edge cases or whatever else. Because a lot of third-party code out there, there's this myth that open source stuff will be really well tested and will kind of be like battle hardened and you can rely on it more than stuff you write yourself. But that's only true sometimes. That's only true for some things. That's how true that is kind of a function of how popular that code is. So if you're using something that is in use by everybody from Facebook down to Casey's blog engine, chances are that's been well tested and that the bugs have been found and the edge cases have been hit, and you're not going to be the biggest person using it, and you're not going to hit many problems. But when you're just pulling in third-party code from a lot of things, it's often hard to tell whether what you're pulling in is of that level of quality or not. And when you're in a young language or a module for doing something that most people don't need to do, kind of like a niche module. I don't know how to pronounce niche, by the way. It's niche. Forget it. But every time I say it, I worry about that.
I'm the same way. I'm right there with you.
Good. Okay. So we'll just agree that we're pronouncing it badly. Anyway, so the fewer people use the thing you're working on, and the fewer big people use it, the less reliable it inherently is simply by being open source or third party or whatever. So I just learned over time that I was better off writing stuff myself and avoiding dependencies. Even when they work well, they can cause issues, like when the version of something changes and it breaks other things. And package managers can solve problems like that most of the time, but I've never seen a single one that solved them all of the time in anything, Linux, languages, anything. I mean, like, when you add dependencies like this willy-nilly, you're really just adding work and risk. And the idea that, like, you won't be able to deploy your site onto new servers because the original host of this 11-line function took it down? Like, that's crazy. Like, there are so many problems with that sound just crazy to me. Like, why are you not in control of that? I don't know. As somebody who has run large-scale services before, every dependency like that just, to me, is a huge liability. And occasionally it is worth using third-party code, but I think it's a lot less often than what people seem to be doing these days.
Well, everybody builds on top of something. I mean, it's not like you're saying, well, I was using the compiler that came with my system, but eventually I learned I had to write my own compiler. You know, I was using the OS to ship with my servers, but eventually I learned that it's wasteful to try to rely on Linux because you never know what the hell they're going to do and they can break your crap. So it's better to write your own OS. Like, we all go on top of something. It's all just a question of where you draw that line and why. So there's sort of, for most of our lives, been the idea that, like, you're not going to write your own OS and your own compiler. And maybe you're not even going to write your own web server. But if you're writing web applications at a certain point around the web server code boundary, then it's like, now it's kind of more up for grabs. Do you use an application framework or do you write your own framework? It was the type of thing where you can write your own web app framework. Like, it's not, that's how all the ones we have got here. Like, it doesn't take a 700-man team to do it. One person can do it.
Yep, I did.
If you use one of the popular third-party ones, chances, and you happen to be in Marco's unfortunate/fortunate situation of you end up being, maybe perhaps unexpectedly, one of the biggest users of everything that you do because you are tremendous all of a sudden, the compounding growth or whatever.
And let me point out, too, Tumblr was not that tremendous when we started hitting these problems. We probably had maybe 100,000 users when all this stuff started breaking. It wasn't that big of a service. Like, relative to what you consider like a scaled or scalable web service, it was nothing.
Well, I mean, sometimes when people start going to Facebook is a great example. They were using a similar technology stack, and their solution was throw people and money at the problem to the point where they were compiling PHP into C++ and crazy stuff like that. That's another possible approach, and I don't know if they decided to write everything themselves. They got down and said, we're going to rewrite the language ourselves, and what is that, hip-hop their replacement thing or whatever. But those are, I feel like, are extremes. I think, for the most part, most companies that are doing web development, I don't know if I'm going to say for the most part, maybe it's 50-50, using in-house web frameworks. In the modern era, though, there are so many popular web frameworks that work for so many needs that it's accepted that you're going to build on top of them. I think where there are two places where this silly JavaScript, well, maybe three places where silly JavaScript stuff fell down. One is an area that I'm familiar with, because JavaScript is a crap language. that is missing really important things that people want, right? And Perl started out as a crap language that was missing many important things that people wanted, and still today is missing some things that people wanted, which means that to sort of round out your language, Ruby has this a little bit of degree too, because they consider it an asset, to sort of round out your language and make it habitable, you know, to make it comfortable, there's a minimum amount of sort of furniture you need to buy for the house before you can move in, and it's not part of the language. It's you know, done in libraries, right? So JavaScript is definitely in that situation, which is why there's all these things that, like, you know, CoffeeScript and TypeScript and other things that are like, try to make JavaScript feel nicer. Those aren't libraries, but the same idea that no one wants to just use JavaScript by itself, because even basic things like, say, left padding a string are not in the language or the standard library, where standard library is defined as what you can run in a browser, right? So someone's got to write the stupid 11-line function, right?
Not in PHP, they don't.
Or, you know, I know, or like the isArray package they're talking about, like the common test that people want to do that's not in the language, that it's easy to write, but it's also easy to get wrong, and it's just kind of like a basic thing, right?
So yeah, you don't have to do that in PHP either.
Yeah, JavaScript, nor Perl, by the way. JavaScript is in that position, and so that's why these things exist. The second problem is the JavaScript community not sort of having their act together enough to realize, all right, so we have this language that has these gaps. The best way to fill them is not with 10 billion individual dependencies, each of which does one of those functions. Like, as a community, they should have, you know, sort of come together and settled on some much larger libraries that are like, and round out the JavaScript language for me, lib 1.0, right? And maybe there's seven competing ones of those, but that is much better than, I'm going to do left pad, I'm going to do sane regular expression matching, you know, I'm going to do fake inheritance in a prototype-based language, and, you know, like, everyone's sort of just doing the little tiny thing and having a million of those combined. And I think the third failure for all the people who got hit by this bug is people who grew up in an environment where the expectation is that you can run your deploy and part of the deployment or updating or syncing or whatever automated procedure they have that they're all happy with, they're not thinking about the fact that it is connecting to third-party servers to do that.
Right.
If you're just slightly older, if you're like, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years older than the people who are running into these problems, you would have grown up in a culture like I did where, you know, you're building on top of Perl. There are gaps in Perl and you're going to need to the libraries. There's web frameworks. Maybe you're writing your own. You're certainly building on top of some real basics like DBI and LWP or whatever the hell, you know, the sort of core foundational things that most people who use Perl want to do. But if you're in a big, important company, you don't go out to CPAN to get these packages, right? You have your own internal CPAN mirror at your company checked into version control, so you know exactly what the hell you're getting, and nothing anybody can do on the internet is going to change what you deploy. Like, nothing is going to break your stuff based on what's on the internet, and you maintain that mirror and you sync upstream and downstream, and you control your own destiny. It's tons of third-party software. Like, a CPAN mirror, especially back in the old days, was pretty darn big, and it's like, why do we have to have our own CPAN mirror? Like, because you don't want to rely on stuff on the internet. For security reasons alone. Like, so that the idea that pulling something from a repository would break people's production systems, those production systems were pre-broken, not by the fact that they were relying on third-party code, not just by the fact that the third-party dependencies were broken down into microscopic individual functions with ridiculous names, but because they weren't masters of their own destiny. No matter what you choose to do in terms of dependencies, you can decide based on what Marco was talking about, you know, is it reliable? Is it suitable for my purpose? Am I better off doing it myself? Is it a core competency? But like, all these sorts of decisions, eventually you're going to do everything. You're going to do some things with third-party code, whether it's your OS or your compiler or whatever, but especially if it's package management, you have to have that stuff in-house. And these days, it is nothing to have a complete mirror of some public repository in your, you know, or just the individual packages you want, check them into your version control. You don't need the whole freaking repository. The repository doesn't need to be involved in your build and deployment process. Just get the code that you need, and then that code will never change out from under you. If it is suitable for your purpose, it will continue to be suitable until you decide that it's not. So anyway, in summary, whippersnappers.
Wow. I don't even know where to go from here. All I will say is that it's interesting that you bring up deployment, because one of the things that I was thinking about when this was all going down was that when I deploy Camel to Heroku, what I'm deploying is just my code, including my my list of dependencies. And just like you said, John, Heroku is then going out to NPM and fetching all of these packages on my behalf. So this very well could have bitten me if myself or one of the packages I depend on was dependent on the one that got pulled. So this is exactly something that I could have run into because of the way I choose to host my site. And I choose to host on Heroku for a variety of reasons, but mostly, like you said, about core competencies. I don't have the time, interest, or desire to be a Linux server admin. And so I choose, for better or worse, to have a platform as a service. And that's what I like. But that's what I like. And that's what works for me. That's how I've chosen to do it. And yes, there are ways around this, even with Heroku, but my point is, even an innocent bystander like myself, I am potentially guilty of doing the same thing.
That's weird to me it doesn't really matter, practically speaking, that you're pulling from the internet as you deploy. Like, I don't understand why that needs to be a dynamic part of the process. Like, I feel like that should be pulled down, like the same way you pull something from CocoaPods and now it's part of your application. Every time you compile, it doesn't re-download it from CocoaPods and silently update it to a different version or get it, like, or just you never actually have it. And, like, I know it's, like, more dynamic and just like, oh, we're all this interconnected web and network connections never go down and I can trust what's on the other side of the network. But I don't understand how you can trust it, honestly. I mean, I don't even, you know, this is another weird CPANy thing, but like, what kind of security is there? If you're dynamically pulling every time you deploy, you're just trusting, you don't even know what the hell NPM repositories Heroku is using and how they might be poisoned with what, like, I mean, again, it doesn't matter for a personal site. This is not a specific issue. It's just the culture of, it's the same culture that gives you websites that end in .io that implore you to, you know, run curl and pipe it through bash. You know what I mean? It's that kind of culture. It's kind of like a return to the really old days when I was first starting Unix. Like, I've told the story before at BU, all TTYs were world writable. Right? That's how naive they were. Like, it was Telnet. There was no SSH. Your passwords were flying in plain text every time you Telneted or FTP'd anywhere. All TTYs were world writable. It was like the free love 60s, right? And that era came to an end. But then, you know, fast forward 20 or 30 years, and people are pulling from an unknown website and piping to their shell. Sometimes they'd have sudo in there. It would be like someone just put in the chat room. Sometimes they'd be like, seriously, I'm going to pull from a website and pipe to sudo sh? I don't know. It's a utopian world that has never actually really existed and cannot be recreated by wishing it were true.
Oh, my God.
I didn't realize that websites that end in .io are inherently bad. This is news to me.
It's the whippersnappers.
It's the whippersnappers.
Haven't you seen? You've seen the websites I'm talking about, right? Like some cool new technology, and they have a website that ends in .io, and their installation procedure wants you to just run a curl command and pipe it into a shell. Like, no thanks. No thank you. I will not do that. I mean, is it really any better when they had, like, you know, shell archives that you download, like shar files, and you just run those blindly? Maybe it wasn't that much better, but I feel like you're crossing a line when the network is involved and you're just, like, blindly trusting bits going over a wire that you're just allowing to execute on your machine that you just pulled off a website. Because it's like, is it the same as downloading, you know, unknown binaries? You know, like, everything is Turing complete. I understand how it's all equivalent and they're not really that different. And it's like, oh, kids these days, right? But there is a difference. There's a reason, like, we've moved to signed binaries and all the sorts of cryptographic things to assure us that at the very least, the application comes from the person we think it comes from and hasn't been altered. There's a reason that has rolled out on, you know, phone platforms and to a lesser extent desktop platforms and game consoles and everything like that. And the modern practice of executing arbitrary code pulled from websites in your shell flies in the face of that progress.
We are also sponsored this week by Warby Parker, who makes buying glasses online easy and risk-free. Go to warbyparker.com/ATP and order your free home try-ons today. Warby Parker offers contemporary eyeglasses that are extremely affordable and fashion-forward. Glasses should be viewed as a fashion accessory, and they shouldn't need to cost as much as an iPhone, so you can have more than one pair if you want. Now, Warby Parker offers prescription eyeglasses starting at just $95, including prescription lenses. That's cheaper than even the iPhone SE. Now, the titanium collection starts at just $145, including prescription lenses with premium Japanese titanium and French non-rocking screws. This sounds like a watch terminology, huh? They offer prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, so even if you're 20/20, there is something for you at Warby Parker. Now, all Warby Parker glasses include anti-reflective and anti-glare coatings, an excellent hard case, and a cleaning cloth, all no additional charge. They don't want to nickel and dime you. Now, whether your eyesight is good, pretty good, or absolutely abysmal, they have you covered with a wide range of prescription options, from simple reading glasses to advanced digital free-form progressive lenses. For those of you with very strong prescriptions, they also offer ultra-thin, high-index lenses that avoid the whole, you know, Coke bottle look from all that thickness. Now, buying eyeglasses online sounds tricky, but they make it easy and risk-free. The Home Try-On program lets you order 5 pairs of glasses to evaluate at home for free. They ship them to you for free. You get to try them on in the comfort of your home and get feedback from people in real life if you want to. You can keep these frames for up to 5 days, then you can send them back also for free with their prepaid return label, and there's no obligation to purchase after all that. If they're not for you, you can stop right there. You spent nothing. If they are right for you, Warby Parker will get started on your order right away, and they can get prescription glasses to you within 10 business days at most, and usually even faster than that. And they also believe in giving back to the world. For every pair of glasses they sell, they distribute another pair to somebody in need through various vision charities. So whether you can use a nice pair of eyeglasses, reading glasses, or even just sunglasses, go to warbyparker.com/ATP to order your free home try-ons today with free shipping both ways and no obligation to buy. Once again, that's warbyparker.com/ATP. Thanks to Warby Parker for sponsoring our show.
Just today, the Safari technology preview was released, and we'll put the official blog post in the show notes. But basically, the gist is this is a separate app that you download via the web and then is updated, I guess, fortnightly via the Mac App Store. And it's sort of kind of a more stable version of the Safari Nightly, if I understand things right, except that it has one important ability, which I don't believe the Safari Nightlies have, or the WebKit Nightlies have, which is it can talk to iCloud. And so if you're like me and rely on Safari and rely on Bookmark Sync and things like that, you can use the Safari technology preview. The reason this is a segue from what we were just talking about, though, is that I tried this on my work computer. I haven't put it on my personal one yet. And I immediately went to install the 1Password extension. When I did so, I attempted to enter a password for whatever it was I was looking at the time, and the 1Password extension said, oh, no, this isn't signed the way we expect, thus this is dangerous, thus we don't want you to do this. And that comes back to what you were saying a minute ago, John, about cryptographically signing things, making sure that what you're looking at is what you expect, et cetera. So I just thought that was interesting, and good on 1Password for telling me these things, although I couldn't figure out a way to override it, which is a little bit of a bummer. But it still worked really well outside of the 1Password issue. The technology preview worked well. Everything seemed fine to me. I haven't had the chance to kick the tires too much yet, but so far, so good. I've really liked it. Have you guys played with this at all?
I only have one question. Did all of your plug-in icons all kind of shift over to the right side as you were using it, or did they stay where you put them on the left side of the address bar?
Oh, that freaking address bar, even in non-preview Safari, even just in regular Safari, frequently the icons in the toolbar of Safari decide they don't like where they are and would like a new home, and well, then I put them back.
They end up just all, because I think what happens is if they get updated, I think they lose their spot and they always get added on to the right side. So I like a balanced bar. So I have 4 of these buttons that go in the address bar from extensions. I like to put 2 on the left, 2 on the right. And they always end up just having all 4 on the right after, you know, within a few weeks.
Yeah, it's not good about remembering where you put things. In the grand tradition of the modern Apple, they will let you rearrange things sometimes, but they will not respect your rearrangement. The only place I can say that isn't true is to the credit of iOS. Springboard is usually pretty good about not moving your crap. Not 100%. There's every once in a while something will bump out of place, like if you do an OS update and it adds an unmovable, undeletable Apple app and it'll bump your things around or whatever, but it's pretty good. But anyway, Safari toolbars, yes.
Yeah,
I have experienced that. And like I said, I experienced that not in the beta, not in the nightly, but just in the regular stable one, not even during updates. And I usually blame like weird iCloud syncing. Like it loses track of things and it's trying to notice that I added an icon somewhere 6 years ago on a Mac that's no longer in service, but there's some state on some server somewhere inside Apple that wakes up once every 3 months and spews a bunch of XML towards their property list towards my various Macs and perturbs the icons. But
how am I supposed to pin cute dogs to Pinterest if I can't find the Pinterest button in Safari?
That's a problem. Find them to key shortcuts. But the most important feature of Safari Technology Preview, still unmentioned. What is the most important feature?
Oh, the copy the clipboard thing so you can get rid of Flash?
No. It's got a purple icon. Come on. It's the whole reason anyone would ever... Why would I want to use this? Well, it's purple. Purple is better than blue. And definitely better than nightly, which is gray. The purple icon is actually, you know, I do like it. I do like it better, and it does look neat, and it's a reason you might want to try it. But it highlights the one disappointing thing for me about it. I would have preferred the Chrome system, where you can just sort of tell Chrome, go on the beta channel or whatever. You only have one installation of Chrome, and you just say, but Chrome, update yourself from the beta channel instead of the regular channel. And the reason is Safari is still my default browser. And I realize that I'm pretty much never going to use the Safari Technology Preview unless I sort of disable or make inert the standard one so that the preview can sort of take over as my default browser. But I don't really want to do that either. Like I would prefer to just have one Safari and switch it back and forth from should I be pulling updates from the beta thing or not. But this is certainly better than it was before, because I never really ran the nightlies for the reasons that Casey covered, that, you know, it wasn't signed by Apple, so you couldn't have the iCloud connection and everything. So this is a step up, but I don't really want to run two copies of Safari, and I don't want to have to zip up the old one. And I'm not entirely confident that even if I tell the OS that my default browser is this one, that the other one isn't going to launch on its own. I don't know. Maybe I should give it a chance. Maybe I should try using the purple one for a while and see if the blue one comes back to life zombie-like unless I zip it. But anyway, lots of good new tech in, like Casey mentioned, in the new one, a bunch of Shadow DOM stuff, ECMAScript 6, which is a slightly less crappy version of JavaScript.
So much hate.
Yeah, the copy and paste, not paste, sorry, the cut and copy commands, which is great. And I love that they highlight, you know, this is the only reason anyone still has legit reason to run Flash, because it's the only way to get stuff onto the clipboard. We do it at work, because sometimes you just want to have a link that you click that copies something into the clipboard. And having to run Flash for that has always felt gross. So another browser supporting it natively is good. But anyway, purple icon, thumbs up.
Another interesting thing here, I'm going to read you the entire cut and copy portion because it's very short. Programmatic cut and copy to the clipboard. It's now possible to programmatically copy and cut text in response to a user gesture with blah and blah code. Having this ability may eliminate some websites' last need for the Flash plugin. So yes, I love the dig on Flash, but when I tweeted about this earlier, a handful of people were like, oh God, people are just going to start pasting things in on me, or they're just going to start copying what's in my clipboard. What is this going to mean for 1Password? And a few people were getting very upset. And I think it's important to note, one, that this is write only. Two, it's in response to a user gesture. And three, I'm very curious to hear what that gesture is. Is it that it can only be on like a click handler or something like that? Is it something more explicit? I'm not sure. But nevertheless, I think this is a really good thing.
And it's already support. I think Chrome already supports it. Like other modern browsers have ways to get things onto the clipboard without Flash. Right, so Safari's not the first one to implement this feature. And yeah, the security, it's useless for even in response to a gesture. Like everything can be used to exploit eventually, you know, with some sort of buffer overflow or whatever. But they can't pull, websites cannot get at what's in your clipboard. All they can do is take their crap and put it there, which could still be annoying, like those stupid things, you know, when you try to copy and paste text and they put the little attribution line next to it. Like we've all seen that one. That it can still be annoying to put stuff into your clipboard. But annoying websites are always going to be annoying no matter what. And so if a website does that, you just won't go back to it, or we'll just deal with the annoyance. But they can't, you know, if you copy sensitive information and go to a website, this feature does not allow the website to get at that information in any way.
Yep. No, this is a good thing. And it's another example of a slightly more transparent Apple, which I approve of. I'm really pleased with the way 2015, 2016 have been with Apple being more transparent with Swift, with this. This is all good stuff, and they should be commended for it.
Yeah, remember we talked about Safari as the new IE kind of stuff? Like, not that this is a direct reaction to that, but this specifically addresses a lot of the actual issues raised in that. Like, oh, why isn't Apple doing more on Shadow DOM or whatever? Like, the idea that they just had the nightlies and it was an opaque development process and you had to wait for the next version of the OS to come out to get the thing. Now this is, you know, incremental step towards, even if you're not a developer and you're just a regular user and you want to get features earlier, here's a more convenient way to do it, even more convenient than the nightlies that we've been building for you for years. And here's us talking about on our blog, because this is not the first blog post. This is far, the WebKit blog has been updated frequently to talk about the new features they're planning on adding and just been much more open about stuff that we previously would have had to wait for WWDC to sort of read the tea leaves of the WebKit work, or, you know, because you couldn't even see all the WebKit work because Apple would do stuff internally and they wouldn't commit to the public repository until like they were ready to release. And they're just being much more open about that process, including talking about future products to say, we're adding this, that, and that, and they're going to be coming in a future release, which is, you know, like they've been doing with Swift, is unheard of from the old Apple, sort of talking about future features for products. Granted, obscure, techie, nerd-type products, right, you know, that only web developers or GUI application developers really care about, but still, it, you know, trusting that people are going to understand, oh, well, you promised this feature, whatever, like, if you see the whole development process going out in the open, you'll understand when things get booted out. When, oh, this didn't make it in time for Swift 3. Like, when inevitably some proposal doesn't make it in time for Swift 3, even though they talked about wanting to put it in there, no one will be mad because anyone involved in the process would have seen every step of the way why that thing didn't make it into the process. What else were you doing during that time? When everyone can see the process, it's so much more understandable. It's like, oh, well, that didn't make it into Swift 3. We're kicking it down the road. It doesn't seem like some sinister plan to withhold technology goodies from you. It just seems like the fallout of software development, which has all sorts of unexpected things. And when you've seen all those things happen in front of you, who can be, I mean, I'm sure someone will still find a way to be mad, but very few sane people will be mad about it.
Our final sponsor this week is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free 30-day trial at audible.com/ATP. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. Listen to audiobooks from virtually every genre, anytime, anywhere. You can play Audible's audiobooks on phones, tablets, computers, even iPods. Audiobooks are great for flights, long road trips, or even your daily commute. Now, you may think you don't have time to read books, but you'd be surprised how many audiobooks you can hear each year, even if you only listen to and from work every day. Audiobooks bring books to life. Many of them are read by the authors themselves, which adds an extra dimension to the text. And with Audible.com, you can take risks and try new authors and genres without regret, because they offer their great listening guarantee. If you start an audiobook and don't like it, you can exchange it for another one for free. So see and listen for yourself. When you begin your free 30-day trial, you get your first audiobook for free, and there's no stress or obligation. You can cancel your membership at any time. Now, with more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products, you will find what you're looking for. Get a free 30-day trial today by signing up at audible.com/ATP. That's audible.com/ATP. Thanks to Audible for sponsoring our show.
So Intel has ended TikTok, and I don't really know what to say about this other than I think it's pretty expected. So, John, what are your thoughts?
I'm just kind of sad that I finally nailed down which one was the tick and which one was the talk, and then go and change the process. All the hard work I put in, I studied and studied.
So which one is the tick and which one is the talk?
Shrink is the tick.
Okay.
But it's not that it matters anymore. Now they have much more sensible names. So they had to come up with another, you know, I don't know, catchphrase or whatever, to marketing term for their new strategy.
Thunk?
So instead of TikTok, or TikTok Thunk, they came up with, it's not great. TikTok was much better. So that team did a better job than this team in coming up with the acronym. But this was PAO, and that stands for Process Architecture and Optimization. And so which one is the shrink? It's the one that's called process. Like, it's much easier now. They made that part of it easier, but PAO does not roll off the tongue like TikTok does. So it's basically, you know, process is the tick. Architecture is the talk. That's when they produce a new microarchitecture, a new chip that has a, you know, a different number of execution units and different branch prediction and different cache size. And, you know, like, it's a new architecture. And then they're adding a new third phase called optimization, which, as far as I'm aware, I'm looking at an older article here, we'll link in the show notes from AnandTech. As far as I'm aware, they haven't really nailed down what's going to happen in the optimization phase beyond saying, well, it's not going to be a shrink and it's not going to be a new architecture. It's going to be this third time when we do other things. What can they do in optimization? They can make the integrated GPU better. They could, you know, maybe make it use less power through more clever, you know, power management or throttling or thermals or, you know, I don't know what they're going to do in the optimization phase. We'll find out, but it's going to be a formal part of the process. And as many people in the chat room are snarkily trying to imply, like, TikTok may have been the strategy in name for the past year or two, but the sort of the length of the tick and the length of the talks have been stretching out in weird ways. And really, this three-phase architecture is just more of an acknowledgement of what was sort of happening already, that the timescales are stretched out more, and that Intel wants to recognize that and set expectations to say, we are going to do a new process, and then we're going to do a new architecture, and then we're going to sort of work on the two of them together for a little while longer to give the next process a longer time to hopefully arrive on our new three-phase schedule. So we're all sort of still staring at sort of the oncoming train of the end of Moore's Law. The real end is very far out in the distance, theoretically speaking, but practically speaking, there need to be... It's getting harder and harder to make things smaller and smaller with lithography techniques. And the research and the money required to go down to the next smaller size is like, you know, the real next breakthrough has to be like, do we have to continue to use lithography, you know, sort of shining, not so much light or, you know, shining forms of electromagnetic radiation onto a thing to cause the areas exposed to react differently than the non-exposed areas. That's what we've been doing for our entire lives to make integrated circuits. I don't know what's next, assembling transistors out of individual atoms or weird technologies that, you know, in the, you know, sort of the R&D realm. You can definitely make things smaller that way, but you can't make them at scale. And so there's this sort of general research gap. But anyway, Intel plows bravely forward. And the last show, we talked a lot about Intel missing their dates and holding up Apple's things or whatever. But the bottom line is they're still ahead of all their competition in terms of their process, how far along they are at different process sizes. And that continues to be an advantage for them. And maybe they'll be the ones to make the next step before everybody else because they're putting in the time and energy and they're already ahead of everybody else. So you can't really be picking on Intel too much because they are sort of at the bleeding edge of this. But if there is a wall out in the future, Intel may just get to it first and then everyone catches up with them and then Intel's advantage is gone. So stay tuned for the ATP episode in 15 years when we revisit that topic.
Oh goodness, I can only hope. All right, so speaking of Intel kind of falling on its face and speaking of really crummy and loose segues, the Oculus founder said that the Oculus Rift, which was shipped in the last day or two, right? Anyway, the Rift will come to the Mac only if Apple quote ever releases a good computer quote. Maybe that's all Intel's fault. So what's going on here? By what metric is Apple not releasing a good computer?
I mean, I hit on this a little bit last week. I mean, the main thing is that the Oculus requires a pretty intense graphics card, and over time, you know, more pedestrian ones will probably be able to drive it just fine. But right now it's so cutting edge and it has such high graphical needs that it requires a really, really high powered graphics card. And there's only a handful in the PC world that are good enough to do it, and Apple ships none of those in any of their computers. The only computer that could even come close would maybe be the Mac Pro, but the current Mac Pro is 2.5 years old or so, and has fairly outdated GPUs as a result of being so old. But I think we covered this a little bit last week, so I don't want to go too far into it now, but I think the short version is that there's a few problems here, most of which Apple doesn't appear to care about. You know, as I'm sure John will discuss in a second, I don't think Apple cares that much about games on the Mac. But, you know, Apple has so far for a long time now tied their updates to Intel's updates. And as we discussed, as Intel's cycles have been getting longer between major updates to their CPUs, that has also stretched out Mac update cycles. And Apple's habit, as discussed last week, of skipping some processor generations that Intel gives them for their lower volume products like the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro, and, you know, even some of the laptops these days. For their strategy, Apple's strategy for skipping some of the things that they could use, kind of like holding off till better ones come later, that's also working against them, because again, as the Intel generations have gotten longer, we now have like a situation that we've that we have today with most of the laptops, where we're sitting around waiting for the Skylake revision from Intel to come out in quantity so that Apple can ship the new MacBook Pros. And meanwhile, the ones you buy today have something like a 3-year-old CPU in them. So something here has to change. You know, either, well, I hope something has to change. We'll see if it actually does or not based on Apple's actions. But obviously, Intel can't deliver new generations of chips any faster. We're seeing that. You know, we're seeing that they are slowing down in their rate of being able to deliver these things because just everything's getting harder. So Apple needs to either be okay not getting these markets and be okay selling 3-year-old hardware in Macs, you know, brand new today on a regular basis, or Apple has to stop skipping Intel generations, which would generally cut their product cycle time in half because they tend to skip every other generation on some of these products like the Mac Pro. Or Apple can start issuing updates to products even when there is no new CPU to use from Intel, which they have occasionally done, but it's not a routine thing for them. Any of those things could solve this problem. Also, you know, then you have the issue of, like, even if they kept their products more up to date, what products does Apple sell that could accommodate the size and thermals of a high power GPU? And it's basically like 1.5. It's like the Mac Pro for sure, and then maybe the big iMac, depending on, you know, the cooling requirements and everything. And, you know, you basically have two Macs that Apple could plausibly put really high power GPUs in, and both of those are probably pretty low volume products for them, especially the Mac Pro. So it just seems like Apple doesn't really care to address this market, which I think is unfortunate, because I wish Apple had a little bit more hunger in attracting people from PCs than they seem to. But with the exception of the whole iPad stuff, but that's a whole different thing. But I do wish they would solve this more often, because I think it would make Macs better also. And if Apple ever has VR ambitions, this will hurt them as well. But for now, this is the situation we're in, and we'll see if any of those factors change.
Yeah, Apple's attitude towards these things has been frustrating. Like, a couple of years ago, I wrote something on my blog asking for the cheese grater that hadn't been updated in forever. Back when the show just started, that was one of the reasons their icons was the old cheese grater with the sarcastic new label on it, because they introduced a new Mac Pro that was barely new, and it's like, are you ever going to update this? What's the deal? And I was asking for them to, you know, is there anyone left at Apple who really cares about high-performance computers? No, they're not going to make a lot of money for you. No, they're not going to be high volume. You know, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. But if you are computer enthusiasts, isn't there someone there who, like, really likes fast, great computers? Just like the example I use for Halo cars in the car industry, where lots of car companies make a car that's probably going to be a money loser for them, just because car companies are filled with people who love cars, and people who love cars tend to love fast cars and beautiful cars. And so they make these cars that are just, you know, you might look at them as a boondoggle. Like, you spend all this money on R&D, it's got all these custom parts, no one's even going to use this thing, and it's weird and finicky or whatever, but you make it because you love cars, right? And they did that. The two Mac Pro, I mean, you may not agree with their vision, but you can't say that they just kind of punted it and just like, oh, here's another tower computer. They had the vision of this crazy tube-shaped computer, like, that this was their vision of high-performance computing, and it, you know, it had these, at the time, fairly powerful video cards with 12 gigs of VRAM, which was unprecedented, shipping stock on a Mac, and it was, you know, like, it was interesting and innovative on all fronts. Was it a good supercar? Was it a good Halo car? Well, maybe not, or whatever. But then you can't go, and then just let that sit there. Like, nah, you just lose interest, right? Because that's sort of like on-again, off-again thing, where it's like, we love high performance, here's an amazingly expandable Mac that looks like a cheese grater, and it's easy to open up, and you can swap the RAM, and we'll update it frequently, and we'll, you know, you can put in different video cards, and it has slots, and look how easy it is taking in and out the drives, and the first one can only do two drives, and now this one can do four, and it's even easier to get the drives in and out. And, you know, they made a water-cooled one. Like, it seemed like they were on that bandwagon for a pretty long time, and then they lost interest, and then they came back and were interested, and then they said immediately lost interest again. And that's not a way to attract people who have similar sensibilities. Like, hey, are you one of the people who's like, you know, a gearhead who loves, you know, supercars and high-performance cars? Do you like big high-performance computers in some respects as an end in and of themselves? Like, you don't even need this, but you just think it's cool, the same reason people buy fast cars that they can never drive at the full speed that they're going to drive. You know, it's like, if you're that type of, does Apple care about the customer? Sometimes they do, because there are people inside Apple who are like that, but then all of a sudden they don't again, and it becomes hard to trust the company. And so many people, so many things I've, you know, been reading lately about pros who, you know, maybe these people who actually have legit need, like professional graphics people or professional 3D people, professional video people or whatever, saying that sometimes Apple, it pays attention to them, but then they don't, and they're kind of tired of the rocky relationship, and they're going to somewhere that has more consistently supported them, and they're switching to PCs or whatever. Gamers have long since made that decision and say Apple has never really cared about gamers, and only incidentally when they shipped machines where it was easy to swap video cards, could you buy a PC video card, flash it for your Mac, shove it in there, and then boom, you've got a Mac that is actually a really good gaming PC as well. That's part of Palmer Luckey's complaint here. The quote I put in the notes about this is, you can buy a $6,000 Mac Pro with top-of-the-line AMD Fire Pro D700, and it still doesn't match our recommended specs. Like, it doesn't even meet, like, here's sort of like the, here's what we think you should have for the Rift. A $6,000 Mac Pro doesn't meet it. Like, maybe, you know, when that $6,000 Mac Pro was introduced, it would have been a reasonable thing. Like, if Oculus had come out then, their minimum spec may have been lower, like, you know, lower resolution or whatever, lower target frame rate, whatever the things are. But nowadays, it's the same computer. It's still $6,000, and it's still got the D700 in it, and the world has just moved on by leaps and bounds. Even when it was introduced, in this case, the D700 was not a gaming-focused card. So even when it was introduced, there were gaming cards that were way faster, right? But now it's just ridiculous. But the price hasn't gone down, right? The whole Apple thing of, like, we will continue to sell the same computer for the same price for 3 years, while the rest of the world moves on, which you can get away with in some markets, but if you're going to do anything in sort of the high-end, pro, super powerful, or whatever, like, I just wish the Mac Pro, whether it pays attention to gaming at all, I just wish the Mac Pro would be the best, fastest computer in the world at something for any sustained period of time, because I feel like that is entirely possible. Fine, make it the best computer for running that weird, you know, painting, you know, 12 megapixel textures in real time onto models thing they demoed at WWDC for Pixar and everything. Make it the best computer in the world for that, for more than 15 minutes. Like, it doesn't even have to be games, but I think it should be something. And it just, it's sad that they've been neglected like that, and it's sad that in this case, Apple is completely missing out, as far as we can see on the outside, on the entirety of VR, which, who knows? I really hope Apple has all sorts of VR projects internally and they decided that it's not ready or not interesting, or the form it's taking on PCs they're not interested or whatever. But they're not allowing people who buy even their highest-end computers to participate in it, even speculatively. So it's kind of depressing. And the final point is, with the whole Palmer Luckey slamming the Macs, I think he's slamming them with reason, but it doesn't mean that you need an amazingly powerful graphics card to do quote-unquote VR. You need it for the Oculus Rift, which is a particular VR product, but as we talked about earlier, if you have a PlayStation 4, you can get PlayStation VR for a couple $100 extra. It's not going to be as good as the Rift. It's not going to be as powerful, but it will run on your PlayStation 4, which is nowhere near as powerful as the recommended system for the Oculus Rift. So VR does not equal Oculus Rift. They're two different things. This is a specific product, and VR is a concept. Hell, they have ones that you can use on your cell phone. Now, obviously, the Rift is probably going to be the highest end one or whatever, but you don't have to entirely miss out on VR because you don't have a fancy high-end gaming PC. If you're interested in it, as at least Marco and I both are, we'll try it out on a couple $100 thing we buy on our PlayStation, and it'll probably be weird, and it's the very first consumer release of this technology, so inevitably, 10 years from now, we'll look back on this VR and think either it's ridiculous that we even considered VR to be a thing, or look back at it and look at how incredibly primitive it is compared to what comes after it. So we'll link to that piece in Polygon, basically saying your Mac is fine for VR, just not for the Rift, which, again, it's high-end versus capability. Like, I want some Mac somewhere to be the best computer in the world for some demanding computational function, because I'm into fast computers. That's why. Like, I don't feel like I need any way to justify it like that, and I wish there were more people in Apple that had the same attitude.
Yeah, and it isn't just about gaming or VR. You know, like, even if VR doesn't take off, or even if you can disregard gamers as a market Apple cares about, lots of Apple software or software that Apple customers would have run can make use of the extra resources of a well-equipped Mac Pro. You know, the Mac Pro is the only computer in the Mac lineup that can have more than four cores. And as discussed previously, much to John's chagrin, I run a utility in my menu bar called iStat Menus.
Me too.
that uses up all those cores.
It shows me when my cores are in use and by what. And I've noticed, you know, like over the last few years, you know, even though making software multi-threaded is difficult and not everything can effectively take advantage of multiple cores, I have noticed in recent years that a lot more of the things that I do are taking advantage of multiple cores. And there's lots of, and even stuff that a lot of people would use, like Apple's Photos app, for instance, or any, you know, any kind of heavy photo workflow, Lightroom, Photos app, Aperture, you know, if you do any kind of video stuff, of course, that'll use it too. Lots of software that a lot of people use can take advantage of any amount of cores you give it, you know, within reason. So, you know, you can, right now, you know, the iMacs and the 15-inch MacBook Pros have 4 cores. I would love to have an 8 or 12 core Mac Pro. That would be amazing. But right now they're not that competitive, because there's no reason to buy one, right now with the prices and the age of them and everything. But like there's so much software now, so many common needs that lots of Apple customers do have that could take advantage of this. You don't have to just be a video editor or a high-end gamer to want a Mac Pro. You know, and I can complain at length about the trade-offs made by the new Tube Mac Pro compared to the old cheese grater. It is overall a good product if it was updated on a regular basis. But, you know, the old cheese grater, I think, was a better one, honestly, in many ways. But I at least want something, some sign that somebody at Apple both A, cares about the Mac, which is, I know a lot of the executives do care about the Mac, but sometimes it's hard to see the actions of that on the outside. And B, that somebody high up at Apple cares about high-end pro use of the Mac. And that is the part that's been seemingly fading in recent years, and I worry about that. You know, it's one thing to exit the software game, you know, to discontinue Aperture. Final Cut, I think they're still okay on. I don't know much about the video world, but I think they are maintaining that okay. Logic, they're maintaining okay. You know, even if Apple starts slacking off on the software side of addressing the pro market, it worries me greatly when they start ignoring the hardware side, because like the software side, we have good alternatives. You know, if Aperture went away, well, we have Lightroom, you know, and we have the new Photos app. If Final Cut goes away, there's like Avid and other things people use. You know, if Logic goes away, there's other audio editors. But if there's no more high-end Mac hardware, you have to abandon the entire Mac platform to have an alternative to that, which is a really high bar, and it's a really big ask, and a lot of people like me don't want to do it. I don't want to abandon the Mac. I don't want to build a Hackintosh or switch to Linux or Windows. I want to keep using Mac OS. And Mac OS was designed incredibly well and incredibly well architected to take advantage of incredibly high-end hardware that Apple just doesn't really sell anymore. And that's kind of sad.
Well, the OpenGL stack is not great, but aside from that, yeah.
I mean, I think you make a decent point, Marco, but I also don't think we should be throwing in the towel quite yet. I mean, I would agree that they don't update things like the Mac Pro as frequently as anyone in the world but me would want. I'm perfectly happy with them not updating it, but every 10 years, so I don't have to go through another one of those months of this show when that's all we talked about. But, but you know, in all seriousness, I don't think that we should be too disgruntled or sad that we haven't seen one in admittedly a fair bit of time, because presumably this will get fixed and it will get fixed soon enough. And I don't blame you for being grumbly about the pace with which they're refreshing the Mac Pro, but it's got to be coming. I mean, it has to be, and presumably soon.
I hope so.
That sounds like exactly what we were saying when the cheese grater was over. Like, well, but they've got updated eventually. Yeah, and then eventually we enter the second phase, which is like, maybe they're never going to update again. Maybe they're just going to stop selling Mac Pros. Like, that was the headspace we were in around about the time that the Tube appeared. Because we were seriously considering, well, you know, Apple really has a consumer focus lately, and they're all about the iPhone and the iPad. And, you know, do they really need the Mac Pro in their lineup? Not really. Maybe they feel like they can get away. Like, maybe they just won't make any more Mac Pros. And then they came up with the Tube. And like I said, you can argue about whether the Tube is the correct vision for high-performance computing, but you can't say they skimped. You can't say they just gave you a watered-down iMac in a tube shape. Like, that thing was a Mac Pro through and through, with their vision of, you know, a whole bunch of ports on the back of the thing and circular and two huge video cards, not one huge GPU, but two huge GPUs in one of them, you know, and their technology for using them for compute is also using them to drive the graphics and the enclosure. And like, it's not the same vision as the cheese grater, but it is a high performance vision. And it was exciting to see that, you know, that was, I think that was actually the Schiller can't innovate my ass thing, right? Like,
yep.
Can't innovate anymore my ass.
That was legit. You know, you could be crowing about that. You know, and again, like, you could just disagree about their vision of the product, but you can't say that they were skimping and were afraid and were just kind of like dipping their toe into high performance computers. They wanted to make the future of high performance computers, but it was just been so painful to see that thing land and then just nothing for so long, especially since when that landed, you know, as we discussed much on the show, what Marco and I wanted was, what was I calling it back then? The quad 27-inch display, right? We, you yep. know, and we knew this thing couldn't drive it, right? And it was like, well, but this is the first one. You know, it can't drive it. Maybe it could drive it. No, it can't quite drive it or whatever. But, you know, it's not quite the one that we want. But, okay, maybe the tech's not ready for it. But surely the next one will do it. We didn't think the next one was going to come 3 years later. You know, we thought.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we both got 5K iMacs. Well, my wife did anyway. So we've got our display, but it's not an iMac Pro, and the current Mac Pro still can't drive it, and we assume the next one will be able to drive it, but we don't know when that one's coming. And
even that's a question mark, honestly. Like, whether the next Mac Pro will be able to drive a 5K display is honestly still a question mark. But to me, like, I've complained in the past about, like, about the drive-by software updates, that, like, lower priority things seem to get, like, these drive-by updates where, like, they'll get attention for, like, an hour. You'll have one engineer working on something for, like, a week and then never allowed to touch it again. And that's how you get something like the El Capitan disk utility. It seems like the Mac Pro, from what we know so far, and, you know, maybe Apple's about to prove us all wrong on this. I hope they are. But from what we know so far, it seems like the Mac Pro update to the Tube was a drive-by hardware update where they were ignoring it for a long time. And then they had this great update that, you know, again, I can complain a lot about what they did to it because I think they made it a lot more narrow, you know, and a lot more expensive than what it was before. They really narrowed the appeal and they eliminated a lot of totally valid use cases. But they did innovate, you know, as Phil Schiller's ass said, they did innovate. But if they innovated and then they just kind of dropped the ball after that, like, there are new CPUs for that they could have used in the meantime and they skipped a generation.
They could have upgraded the GPUs.
Yeah, they could have upgraded just the GPUs. If they're so focused on this machine having these two workstation GPUs that somebody like me who would want to buy the machine doesn't need at all, I would gladly buy it with one consumer GPU because I'm buying it for the CPU power and like the RAM ceiling and everything else, like not the GPU reasons. If they're going to refocus the entire machine on this high-end dual GPU use, then follow through on that. And they didn't follow through. The GPUs are sitting there stale forever. I've heard from people who try to use OpenCL for things that it's really kind of been had the ball dropped on it as well. That it just seems like they came in and they did this huge redesign and refocus of this product that we weren't really asking for, and then didn't follow through even on that. So that's why I'm so sad for this product, because I love the Mac Pro. I love, especially what it used to be, I love having this extremely flexible, expandable tower that had two CPU sockets, tons of RAM slots, you could put a whole bunch of drives in it. And granted, you could modernize it in other ways. Like, you know, these days, you don't maybe need as many drives anymore because now we're in the era of SSDs and the drives have gotten so big, you don't need as many anymore. So, like, you can see them removing some of these things. I do still greatly miss dual socket configurations, and I do greatly miss configurations that don't have two graphics cards because I don't need them. But I hope they write this at some point soon. I don't know if they will or not, but I really hope they do. And I'm still maintaining some optimism, because if they don't, the iMac 5K is a great product. You know, I'm using mine. I'm almost always very happy with it. I would like a lot more CPU power. So if I, you know, if they make a compelling Mac Pro that I can get 8 cores in reasonably, I would love that. But if the Mac Pro withers away in irrelevance the way it has been over the last few years, and if it's never good again, I still have the iMac, and that's fine. But boy, I wish I could have the Mac Pro back.
Just because of CPU speed?
Mostly because of CPU speed.
And fan quietness.
Yeah, exactly. Things like being totally silent at any load level is just kind of more graceful and nice. Having the Xeon class components and the ECC RAM and everything makes things slightly more reliable. Having more internal ports, stuff like that, like more USB ports like built in rather than having to use flaky hubs, stuff like that. Like I love all those things about the Mac Pro. In many ways, I miss it. And again, if we never get it back the way me or John want it, we'll deal. We'll be okay. But it does seem like a waste that there's all these amazing CPUs out there at the high-end world. Like in the next generation, the Broadwell Xeons, there's a 5 gigahertz part with 4 cores. If you could have a dual socket configuration, have 2 of those, 8 cores at 5 gigahertz, that would be incredible. That would be the best single-threaded and multi-threaded Mac. But they're not going to offer that because the current Mac Pro design is only one socket, and the CPUs they use can do two. They just don't offer that machine, and it's just like there's so much more they could offer. There are so many great processors in the Xeon line they could offer, and there are so many use cases the old Mac Pro solved that the new one doesn't, and all those things make me sad. But I'm still hoping for a Mac Pro update soon. We'll see what happens, I guess.
Have faith, it'll happen.
Hope so. All right. Thanks to our 3 sponsors this week, Casper, Warby Parker, and Audible.com. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC. USA Syracuse, it's accidental. They didn't mean to. Accidental. Tech podcast so long.
So you added a family member.
I did. Yes, it has wheels though.
You subtracted one too.
Yes, may the M5 rest in peace. I'll miss that car.
You know, I'll tell you what, when I was preparing to drop it off, and when I did drop it off, I was almost in tears. Like, this is the only time that I've ever given up a car that I owned where I was really sad to see it go. Every other time I've either stopped having a car or upgraded to a different car, every other time I've been kind of ambivalent toward my old one for some reason. You know, either, you know, before I was leasing, either it'd be like, you know, because it was costing me a lot of money because it was breaking down constantly, and that's why I was getting a different car. Or like, you know, with my previous 3 Series lease, I knew I was upgrading to the M5. So going from a 3 Series to an M5 was a huge jump, and I was like, oh man, I'm so excited. This 3 Series, yeah, it'll be fine. I'm going to the M5. You know, forget the 3 Series. This time, you know, the M5, it's so good. And it's so different from where I was going that I was almost regretting it. I was almost like, oh, I was almost second guessing my move. Like when I was turning, I'm like, man, am I gonna really regret this? Like, because you know where I'm going is different. It's not all better. It's better in some ways, worse in others. And that M5 just is such a good car that I was really very sad to leave it.
Yeah, I'm sad that you left it behind. I mean, I don't blame you. It's not like you did anything wrong, but I'm sad about it because, you know, I feel like I bonded with that car. I mean, it's the only car I've ever driven. It's the only car I've ever driven in two countries. It's the only car that's ever shuffled me around Germany. It's the only car I've ever been in or driven the Nürburgring on, in, whatever. We as a group of four spent a lot of good times in that car, and you guys as a group of two and three spent a lot of good times in that car. It's sad, but that's okay because you have bought yourself a Tesla. So,
well, I've leased myself a Tesla. they still own it.
Well, that was the problem. You leased the M5 too. It was never really yours.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I know you felt like it was yours, but you were just leasing it. So you were never willing to commit to the M5. You're always like, for 3 years, I'll give you a trial period M5. Maybe I'll like you. Maybe I won't. But you're probably going back.
Believe me. You don't want to own an M car older than 3 years.
I mean, it depends. Like, the thing I'll miss most about the M car is just what we just talked about the Mac Pro. Like, I mean, maybe it's partly where I live, but like, Tesla's like the Toyota Camry of where I live. Like, they're all over the place. Like, but I rarely see an M5. I think there's like two in the whole, you know, extended neighborhood area, but there's like a Tesla on every other driveway. So the Tesla just seems less special because it's less rare. It's also less of a Mac Pro in terms of we make lots of good cars and they're plenty fast, but can we take one of our cars and make it, you know, as good and as fast as we possibly can? And I don't even care what kind of car it is. Even if it's a big giant four-door sedan, we can make that go fast too. Let's work our magic. Like, it's the, you know, it's the almost pointlessly exotic high end, right? And the Tesla, especially since you didn't get the pointlessly exotic high end Tesla, but even if you had, it's still more, it's got other goals because it is a whole new platform, a whole new technology, and it is necessarily more prosaic. We are not at the stage yet where there can even be an electric car that is a regular street car that is as focused on ridiculously excessive performance applied to another car as the most ridiculous AMG Mercedes or the M5s or any sort of supercar type of thing. So I feel like you are taking a step up in practicality and a step down in ridiculous automotive excess.
Okay, well, first of all, I think I disagree with two big things that you just said. Number one, I would say the Model S in its various like supercar configurations, which I didn't get, as you said, like the P configurations and then the one with the ludicrous mode, I would say those maybe are those kind of extreme configurations. And also, I have never seen as many other M5s in one neighborhood as I have when I visited your neighborhood.
There's a lot of fives, and there are a couple of M5s, but the Teslas are everywhere. They are just, like, seriously, it is the Toyota Camry of my neighborhood. Like, when I commute, all I just see is Teslas. And before the Tesla, as I pointed out, much to Casey's upsettedness, The Panamera was the other thing that, like, before Tesla came on the scene.
God.
Panameras were everywhere. And I was like, who's buying these cars? They were everywhere.
We're only talking about happy thoughts this time, John. No Panamera discussion.
Yeah, seriously.
but it's the same type of thing. That the Tesla and the Panamera are both like four-door cars, but trying to be shaped like sporty cars. Like, you know how the Tesla, it doesn't look like an M5. It is definitely more kind of like, I'm a sporty car, but I have four doors. How can we sort of make that look nice? And Tesla does obviously a better job than the Panamera does of it, but they're both doing that type of thing. And it's kind of, I feel like both of them are very similar to Marco, like midlife crisis cars, where, you know, that's why Marco's car is red, right?
Yep.
Where they don't want to feel like they have to get a four-door car, but they do have to get a four-door car. So they go to the Porsche dealership to get a four-door car. And the modern version of that is, I have to get a four-door car because I have a family, but can I get this super fast electric one that I still feel, and get it in red, and now I still feel like I'm, you know, got a cool car.
A couple things real quick. Number one, the Tesla is light years better looking than the Panamera. The Panamera is just hideously ugly. Number two, so I was grabbing the Panamera link for the show notes as we were recording, and I landed on the Panamera model page, which I'll put in the chat room. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. There are, like, what is this, 14 different models of Panamera that run from $78,100 to $263,900 for the Panamera exclusive series.
Why would you want that?
Who in the name of God would pay $250,000 for a Panamera?
You haven't shopped for a Porsche recently. Porsche measures their option packages in units of Hondas. Well, this is a 700 unit package. You know, like, the Porsche options have always been obscene. Their prices are, you know, they're expensive, right? But any Porsche you take, you're like, well, I bet I could add like $10,000 in options. Like, no, one option is $10,000, $11,000, $12,000. If you can add all the options, your car suddenly costs $263,000, and you're like, what happened? I thought I was shopping for $80,000 four-door car, and now Porsche options. I mean, I'm assuming Porsche options are actually rivaled by like Bentley and Rolls, but no one ever talks about how much those options cost, because once you're shopping for that, people don't talk about money anymore. But every time for the past like decade and a half, read a review of Porsche, they're like, oh, and Porsche's options. I don't know what they're thinking, but like, if you want anything, it's thousands of dollars. Doesn't make any sense.
There are 24, is that right? No, 22 911s. 22! How is that a thing?
People like options. I mean, like, if it makes sense to Porsche, like, do you want to pay? I mean, like, all right, it's fine. You're going to pay $15,000 for the carbon ceramic brakes. Do you feel like paying $7,000 for a different headliner on the interior? All right, we'll charge you that. Whatever, dude. Like, how do you feel about special headlights for $3,000? Yes? Okay, check that box.
Sold.
It adds up really fast.
All right, I apologize. I derailed us. I had never looked at buying a Porsche, not that I'm really looking at it now, and I'm just flummoxed by how many options you have. If you can't buy a freaking tube of toothpaste, you'll never be able to buy a Porsche.
Let me teach you a valuable lesson about this podcast. Never apologize for derailing the show.
Yeah, well, I can't trust your judgment on this issue. Have you listened to Top Four? It's a total train wreck. A delightful train wreck, but a train wreck. Which, by the way, listening to John try to keep you within the guardrails on that episode was just wonderful. It was hysterical.
I felt like I kept things contained better than average, I'm going to say. better than the average show.
Still not well. All right, so anyway, we have totally derailed. So tell us about the Tesla. How was the pickup experience? What you've only had it for like 2 days so far.
Yeah.
How is it?
So the pickup experience, I should just say, I mean, you know, we've talked in the past in Neutral and in the after shows here about like different car companies having different dealer experiences. And a lot of it just depends on your local dealers. But sometimes it does seem like the way the company is set up, certain companies have like better or worse dealers and dealer attitudes than others. But Tesla, I've been to two different Tesla dealers and talked to a few other people on the phone here and there, and they've all been awesome. Like super low pressure. I think the salespeople are not commissioned, and so I think that contributes a lot to the easier going nature of talking to them. But overall, just really positive experiences dealing with Tesla so far. Granted, I haven't had to like get tricky service or anything yet, but I know some people who have had Teslas for a while, and they've all reported very positive things about even the service and stuff like that. So far, incredibly positive experiences dealing with them as a company. There's no negotiation on the prices, which also makes things a little bit nicer and simpler. Like, you literally order your car online. Like, you can call them and you can go into the showroom and you can order it there if you want to. But ordering it there is just you using a computer with their public website on it, and you just place the order with them if you want to. So like, it's really refreshingly simple and nice. And everybody who works for Tesla who I've interacted with seems like they were from California. Super like, laid back, like nice, trendy. Yeah. Super nice people. So very, very positive experiences there. The pickup was just like any other car pickup where, you pick it up, you sign some papers, you transfer the license plate and registration.
Oh, so that did work out.
Yes. I got to keep my blue license plate, my blue and white New York plate instead of the ugly new yellow ones. This is now the third car this plate will be on. Because I refused to upgrade to the yellow ones because they're hideous on every color of car.
So it was just like any other car pickup. You just walk down the stairs and your car is on a rotating platform with the battery connected through the floor on it. It's just really just like, and then you go outside and you're in a different country and you drive on the road 140 miles an hour. So pretty much like every other car pickup.
Exactly like every other car pickup, yeah.
I re-listened to that partially because I think Underscored said he had just re-listened to that episode of Neutral. And oh man, I felt so bad for John because you really got kind of browbeat into being on that with us. But God, it was a fun episode and a fun trip. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So, they walked me through like the features of the car and everything.
Which you promptly forgot.
I have actually read some of the manual. I will have you know.
More than 5 pages?
He knows how to open the trunk, at least.
I read, I think, 4 pages of the manual, because a lot of the features of the car are not intuitive. Like, for instance, like the rules of like when and how it locks and unlocks is actually not obvious. So I've had to look up things like, oh, so how do I turn it off if I'm sitting in it? Like, there's... there's like a lot of things like that that are not intuitive. So anyway, and so I actually have referred to the manual a few times. But so, you know, going over the car, taking it out and everything, granted, I'm only 2 days into owning it, as you said. So take all of this with a grain of salt. I might change my mind later. But at the moment, I mentioned how sad I was to give up the M5. But I'm not sad anymore. Like, once I got, I was very sad for like the 2 hours between when I turned it in and when I picked up the Tesla. And I really was worrying, like, I wonder if I made the wrong decision here.
Really?
I really was, yeah. And until I started driving the Tesla. And it reminded me why I went to Tesla in the first place, why I decided to make this move. Never drive a Tesla if you don't intend to possibly buy one. Because when you drive it, it really, I'm not going to say it's disruptive, because it's an abused term, and disruption usually is involved with low-end disruption. This is definitely not low-end disruption, at least not yet. But it is transformative in the sense that once you drive an all-electric car, especially a good one like a Tesla, but you know, even the lower-end all-electric cars like the Chevy Volt and the Nissan Leaf and stuff like that, that are much more affordable, even those have this property where...
Chevy Volt's not all-electric.
Sorry, the Bolt, and it doesn't matter. The Leaf is the only one anybody buys, right? Anyway, so all-electric cars have this property. Once you drive it, it feels so different. And in my opinion, so much better than driving a gas car. It makes gas cars seem like old clunkers, and it makes them seem irrelevant to the point where now that I'm in the electric car mindset, and I'm feeling how they feel and how they drive, and you know, seeing how they work and the advantages they have, there is no gas car on the market that I want. You know, if BMW comes out with, you know, the next M5, which is probably going to have all-wheel drive and probably coming out in a couple of years, I don't think I'm going to care, because I don't want a gas car. Like, once you get used to the benefits of electric, there are still benefits to gas. You know, long highway range is a big one. That electric is not only not there yet, but probably will never be there for maybe our lifetimes, or at least a big part of them, just because of the rate that battery technology improves. But my God, it is so different. It feels acceleration wise like I got the 90D, not the fast, crazy fast one. That's the P version. I didn't get those. I feel like such a douche for even talking about this, because I know these are very expensive cars I'm talking about. But I don't know. If you think I'm an asshole, you probably stop listening by now. If you haven't, stop now. Sorry about that. But anyway, so it feels, first of all, it feels like I'm driving a train, because trains are usually electric. And like I, you know, I spend a lot of time on trains, like in, you know, commuter rails and subways and everything. And the way, and you know, trains are electric. The way they accelerate, it has a certain feel to it. Electric cars accelerate like electric trains do. Like they just, like the torque curve, the way they feel off the line, the way they sound, even, like, it feels like I'm driving this incredibly smooth, futuristic, awesomely powerful thing, in a way that gas cars, even very powerful gas cars, just can't feel. Like they just can't do that. Even now, buying like the like, you know, middle of the road configuration of the Tesla, it's so ridiculously good, and it's so ridiculously fast. I'm so glad I didn't get the faster one, because the faster one is a big price jump and a big hit to range for a difference of speed that not only do I not need, but that I described when we last talked about this as actually unpleasant to me. Like, it was actually too fast, and kind of felt like I was being punched in the face when I test drove that one. So this is a really good configuration for me so far. And, you know, I haven't taken a big trip with it yet. I haven't put up to like a full supercharger and had to wait 40 minutes to even start my charge yet. Like, I'm sure I'm going to have experiences with this car over the next 3 years that I'm leasing it. I'm sure I'm going to have experiences that aren't all roses. But the everyday driving around town, which is what I do the vast majority of the time, is just amazing in it so far. It really is great. I'm even sold on the touchscreen.
I don't know about that.
Again, ask me again in a few months. Maybe, you know, maybe these things will change. But so many things are like just the way it does things, the advancements it has are so nice. And the interior quality isn't as good as BMW. The sheet metal isn't as good. Like the most of the car's other aspects besides the drivetrain are actually a step down from what BMW offers in their high-end configurations. And I don't care. Like, that's how good the drivetrain is. Like, I just don't care about that step down. And it's that's why I'm saying this is like truly transformative slash disruptive, because it makes you ignore the downsides and not care about the deficiencies, because the core of it, the drivetrain, the feel, the handling, it just feels so good. It makes you forgive all the little, you know, little nitpicks that you might have.
So what's your favorite thing so far?
Just driving. Like, it's, I'm like, you know, I'm being stupid. I'm like, you know, finding reason to go run stupid local errands, like just to get me out of the house into the car again. Like, just, it just feels so good. It's so incredibly smooth and immediate and direct feeling. It's just ridiculously good. The more time I spend in it, the more I like it, the more I appreciate it.
Underscore also has a 90D, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And he visited down here, I think it was right after Thanksgiving, around Thanksgiving, sometime around then. And I drove his car, which I think we briefly spoke about on the show, actually. And it ruined my car immediately. There are things
I
that
told you.
There are things that I don't like about it, but I'm sure if I had one, I would suffer through and learn to live with it. I didn't care for the touchscreen, though it did make a lot more sense when I was in the car and seeing all the things I could tweak and configure. It did make a lot more sense than I would have expected. The regenerative braking is really peculiar. I didn't really like it, but I wouldn't say I disliked it either. It was just very, very different and weird.
Well, and that's an option you can turn down also.
Yeah, but I mean, at the cost of range, of course.
A little bit.
But yeah, well, still. The things that car can do, though, both performance-wise and technology-wise, are tremendous. Like, Underscore was saying, if I recall correctly, that he had set up his car such that when he pulls up to his house, it opens the garage, which
yep.
is a totally Apple thing to do, right? Like, it has a GPS on it. It has a garage door opener on it. Tell it, this is my house. This is where I need to use the garage door. So just open the damn garage. Like, it's such an obvious thing to do that I never thought of until he said, oh yeah, it totally does that for me. And I think he said you could even tell it to raise the suspension a little bit when he's arriving at the house, to give him a little extra room to go over like the curb or whatever it is, or the lip.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, stupid stuff like that, but really smart. You know what I mean? And it's stuff like that. It was just so impressive. And the fact that it had an app that didn't suck. Like, I haven't been able to use the BMW Connect or whatever it is app. Well, it was comparatively less sucky than the BMW app that I had used 2 years ago.
Fortunately, there are third-party apps, because they just reverse-engineered the API that the official app was calling.
Oh, that's totally safe.
Yeah. I mean, the API can't do anything harmful. It's like, it can't like stop the car or make it go. It can just like, you know, it can like open the sunroof and turn the heat on and stuff like that. It's like, it's not that big of a deal. But wow, like, you know, simple things like, as you said, like the garage door opening, and it closes when you leave too. Like, when you pull out of the driveway to leave, it can close the garage for you, and then when you come back home, it opens it for you. Like, yeah, you're right, stuff like that. It's just really nice. I mean, and even having, you know, the big touchscreen, like, one of the reasons I'm kind of converting to the big touchscreen now and appreciating it is like, it makes certain things possible or better that you wouldn't necessarily expect from a car. For instance, you know, it just shows like a Google Maps view, and you can turn it on satellite, you can turn on traffic overlays and everything. So you're getting like really, you know, well-reported traffic overlay, traffic data. I just leave the map on all the time now, even when I'm doing local errands, which is most of my driving, because I have multiple routes I can use to get to places I'm going, and I can see the traffic on this giant map screen of where I'm going without having to program in a destination, without having to make a trip out of it, like GPS-wise. I can just like glance at the screen casually, and I can see, oh, that avenue over there is all full of red. Let me take the other way. Just little stuff like that. Like there's the screen enables little stuff like that, or even just like because it's so tall, like it has these different modes where you can have one app taking up the whole screen, or you can split it and you can have a top and a bottom app. And it's such a large screen that you can have like navigation as one of those things, and then the other one could be like the media player or something else. Like it's nice having all of that on one screen. Whereas the other cars I've used, they've had these much smaller system screens where you kind of have to like switch modes between different things, and it's kind of laggy sometimes. And so, I mean, again, and the Tesla one is not perfect. It isn't as fast as I think it should be for a car of this caliber. I have to double check with this. I think I hear a hard drive in there.
Oh, interesting.
As opposed to an SSD. I think I'm hearing, like, if I'm doing stuff in the car and it's parked, like if I was setting up the music system, it was parked, so everything was like dead silent.
I think they're just piping that in to make you feel more comfortable.
That's it. Yep. Fake hard drive sounds.
Pre-recorded audio. they know the age of the people who buy these things, and they want them to feel like they're in a familiar place with spinning hard drives.
Yeah. But overall, it is more responsive than the BMW system was. And it isn't as responsive as like an iPad, but it's not that far off, and it's really, really quite nice. Even like simple things, like one of the little things that I like when driving it, first of all, like when you stop it, it's dead silent, and the whole car is incredibly quiet, which I love. Coming from an M car that's like made artificially louder, and it already is pretty loud to begin with, that's a welcome change to have a quiet car for once. Also, they have a cool hill hold feature where every time you stop the car fully by default, it has a hill hold, so it holds the brake for you and shows a little H on the dashboard when you know it's happening. So you stop at a traffic light and then you can just take your foot off the brake pedal for the entire time you're waiting.
That's weird.
Well, the whole car is weird, but at first, like, it seems weird, and then you start playing with it and you're like, oh, that's really nice, actually. Like, it's just simple things. Like, it's, you know, people always ask, you know, so far about the autopilot stuff and the auto drive and the summoning and everything. And I did autopilot on the test drive. I haven't done summoning or anything else, and I'm probably not going to use these things a lot. I'm a little bit scared to use a beta feature to pull my brand new car in and out of my very tight garage.
Oh, come on.
I'm probably not going to be doing a lot of that.
Speaking of, you got rid of that friggin' M5, and you and I never did a launch control start. God, I'm so angry right now. I completely forgot about that.
I didn't forget about that, and I actually considered doing one on the day I turned it in, like just that morning. But
why wouldn't you have?
Because I had 3-year-old tires, and it was raining.
So, Marco.
I don't think, because even a regular, even a non-launch controlled start in that car, the rear tires would just spin.
I remember. Oh, I'm so disappointed in you right now. I'm not even mad. I'm just disappointed.
Of course.
Well, that's okay, though. I'm really curious to see how this goes a couple of different times. I'm curious to see how this goes the next time you go upstate, either to your family or Tiff's family, because Tiff's family is like right on the ragged edge of your available range, right?
So The short answer is I don't know yet. I mean, by like the rated range, which of course nobody actually achieves, there's tons of headroom.
Okay.
By the actual range driven, it seems as though I will probably have enough range to get there and back on one charge, but without a lot of headroom, so I probably won't want to do that. So I will probably be plugging in there. They have, surprisingly, an extra dryer outlet. That is, which I know most people don't have, but they happen to have one because it's upstate and it's crazy up there. So they have an extra dryer outlet that is within close distance of where I could park. So I'll probably plug in there with an adapter. But, you know, it's fine. I mean, and all the rest of the time in my life, I never have to go to a gas station again.
That's true. But then if you come visit us, that's something like a 400 mile drive, which you're just not going to be able to do on one charge. And so then you're going to have to do the supercharger dance. Now, to be fair,
yeah,
the superchargers started, I think, on the 95 corridor, which is the road that runs almost directly between you and I. So if you're going to choose a place to test out the superchargers, it's a pretty good place to do it, because, I mean, they have plenty of them. But it's still a fairly considerable distance and long enough that you would probably have to stop once, if not twice. Adding a not inconsiderable amount of time to an already like 6 to 8 hour trip to 10, depending on what time you're going. So I'm curious to see if you guys have a reason to visit again. Like, I don't know, maybe if Top Gear or something similar to Top Gear comes out in the fall. I'm curious to see how that trip goes.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it could be totally fine. It could make us think, oh, you know what, we should bring a gas car next time we come down here. I mean, every time I drive to your house, I regret some part of the drive, because there is
thanks,
no,
buddy.
There is no good way to drive to your house and back without hitting some kind of massive traffic problem like this.
Well, I found a way that's if not good, it's not bad at the very least. It's at the worst, it's meh, which is an improvement, because I tell you what, the Washington corridor on I-95 at any time when any human being on the planet could possibly be awake is a disaster. So if you avoid that whole corridor, which I think you guys took that route once, and then I think you ended up in like some other disaster by pure dumb luck, bad luck.
Yep.
But anyways, there are ways to avoid the bad spots, but you're still, it's a crapshoot no matter what. I don't know. I've been talking a lot. You've been talking a lot. John, what are your thoughts and questions?
Well, 2 days in, I don't know. I mean, I really feel like he does have to live with it longer, like especially yeah, the touchscreen stuff, because like you've articulated the advantages of that very well. And I totally see all those advantages, but I still wonder about the minute extra hassle of adjusting the temperature by having to change a screen before you can hit a button, as opposed to a button that's always there. That's just, I mean, I'm annoyed by the physical buttons in my Accord, and those are physical buttons. I'm just annoyed by the fact that they're bad physical buttons. If I had to change a screen to get to it, like, yeah, I don't know.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, first of all, this is kind of like, you know, transmissions that were bad always annoyed me. And now I just don't have one, and it's fine. You know, maybe having no buttons for you is better than having bad buttons.
If you're not a climate control micromanager like I am, you won't bother you as much.
I'm not a climate control micromanager. I tend to just like set it and forget it, like the TV commercials always say. Like, you know, I tend to not play with it very often. Also, to be fair, Tesla climate controls are always on screen, and they're always in the same spot. They're always on that bottom row. So you don't have to like change modes to get there. They're always there. So if you do want to make a quick little adjustment, you can, and you know, it's, you don't have to like, you know, change screens. That being said, there are actually a good number of buttons. They're like all around the wheel. There's levers and buttons like all over the steering wheel, and some of them are even customizable. You can remap them to do certain things. So actually, like, I found, like, I was worried about the cruise controls, like, for, you know, because, like, you know, most good cruise controls you can like manually like set, and you can like raise it up and down by like 1 mile per hour or 5 miles per hour, like by certain gestures or certain pushings of levers. Tesla offers that too. Like, they have a lever on the side of the steering wheel that's the cruise control lever. It's actually easier than BMW, because like most other cars you have to turn the cruise control on as an explicit action, and it's off by default whenever you turn the car on. But Tesla, it's always available. You just hit it and it sets. Like, it's like you actually save a step, stuff like that. Like, it's actually surprisingly well designed, even in its physical controls, for a car that appears at first glance to not have any physical controls.
So at least you have the option of upgrading your controls. Like, the thing that annoys me the most, the biggest downgrade in Honda's climate controls and the series of Hondas that I've had, is the switch from individual buttons for modes in terms of top vent, bottom vent, feet and defogger, you know, like all the different modes of how air can come out of the various vents in your car. The switch from having a dedicated button for every single one of those to a single button that cycles through them. Cycling through is the worst. Nobody wants that. So on your Tesla, does it have a mode switch to cycle through the modes, or does it have separate buttons for all of them?
You don't even know yet.
I don't really know yet.
I mean, the good thing is that, the bad thing is that they're not real buttons. They're just a bunch of things on a screen, and it's hard to find if you're not looking. The good thing is that if they don't have a good setup, you can just wait for the next software update, and there's a chance that they will change, whereas my buttons are never going to get better.
Right.
Oh, that's funny. I don't know. It's interesting to see what you think of this after a while. Speaking of the climate control, though, is there an all mode?
Yes, there is.
That you were missing from the M5?
No, the M5 had it.
It did?
The BMW 5 Series and the older 3 Series have
mine does.
All modes. Yeah, yours does. The current 3 and 4 Series does not have an all button. So with the current 3 and 4 Series BMWs, if you want to raise the temperature of the whole car by 1 degree, you have to turn 2 different knobs once.
I like the idea whoever came up with that, whoever marketing person came up with, like, passenger driver split climate control and then front and rear split climate control. The same person who came up with non-smoking sections in restaurants.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You're all in the same air. You're all in the same air, guys. Like, there's a limit. I know, you know, someone can feel better with warm air blowing on them versus cold air blowing on them, but bottom line, that's not a big space. You're all in the same car.
Well, but it's just crazy making to me that BMW's current 3 and 4 series.
Yeah, no, that's worse. That's like a fallout of, like, so someone came up with this marketing feature that made people feel like it sounds good. You know, we're always different temperatures and this will fix things when it really won't fix them. And then on top of that, to build a missed feature that's like, not only did we make the silly feature, but even if you don't want it, now it adds complication to what used to be a simple thing.
Right. Like, now you have to adjust temperature twice every single time. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's...
Like, at that point, why not just have single zone climate control at that point?
Yeah, my car... This is my first car to have dual zone climate control. My current Honda is the first. I mean, if I could have bought it without it, I would have, but it has come standard. And it annoys me because, I never want to use it, mostly because I'm usually the only person driving the car, and B, the stupid button for, in Honda, it's not an all button, it's a sync button. Basically, when sync is on, everything you do to the climate control affects the whole car, which is how it should be all the time, right? And when I go for other buttons on this completely smooth, seemingly featureless expanse of buttons that are defined by slices into the smooth, featureless expanse, you know, or if I'm wearing gloves or whatever, I accidentally bump the sync button and don't notice until like a day later when I realize I've been adjusting the temperature just for quote unquote my side of the car, and the other side of the car is still set to, you know, totally the wrong temperature, and it's terrible.
I will tell you what, though, my Subaru was the first car I had with dual zone climate, and I love it because Aaron is usually cold and I am usually warm, and being able to adjust each independently is wonderful. However, the Subaru did not have an all button, and my life improved dramatically when I bought the BMW, if for no other reason than because of the all button. Because then I actually tended to micromanage a lot more in the Subaru anyway, but anytime I adjust the air in the BMW, I just have to spin one little spinner, one or two notches, and they're delightful little notches. They're really crisp, really well built, really well done, as only the Germans and probably the Japanese can. It's so much better that way. But you could not pay me enough money to buy a car with one zone climate control. That is insanity to my eyes.
I guarantee you John would have a problem with the knob feel somewhere.
Oh, I know.
Well, I would kill for a knob is another downgrade of the Accord. I don't even have a knob. I have up and down buttons. Huge up and down buttons that are like, and the same type of thing. There's a little bit more of a division between them, but like it's so clearly that like they designed these buttons to look nice and not to be distinguishable as individual buttons. And of all the things, like, I'm glad I have a knob for volume, although honestly I just use a steering wheel controls mostly for that, which is not a knob. But, you know, a knob for fan speed, please. Instead of, that's the worst. That's like the arrow keys on the old Apple. Remember the old Apple keyboard layouts where they didn't have the inverted T, even the half size one? Instead, they had four keys next to each other that was like, I forget the
yep.
order, but like,
oh, left,
right, up, down. Well, so this is the microcosm. Like, I have up and down fan speed buttons. Is up on the left or is down on the left? It's completely arbitrary. It's just like I have a picture in my head. I don't even know which one it is now. But every time I've got to think about it and fumble around and figure it out, I would love a knob for that. And I would love a knob for temperature instead of a granted, very large, like red upward-facing arrow button and blue downward-facing arrow button for temperature.
My kingdom for a knob.
Two knobs.